Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And Matt, we are back with UFC Vegas 17 previews and predictions. And Matt, as always, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP, and as always, at Fight Night Picks. Matt, what a week it was. I mean, we had a ton of programming content last week. We had the return of This Week in MMA, early stoppage. We had the recap show. We had question mark kicks. We had all kinds of great stuff. And we have great stuff planned for the end of the year because, Matt, this has been the craziest year in Fight Night Picks history. I mean, we started last year, I guess this January, really, with just barely even 1,000 subscribers, up over 18,000. And the goal before the end of this year is 20,000. I know you can do it. There's a little over half of you that aren't subbed. So help us out with the sub, with the like, as always. And Matt, we have a really good card to talk about. All kinds of fights. Some shuffled towards this card. Jimmy Flick, Cody Durden, we already talked about it a couple of weeks ago. It's going to be on this card. Another fight that we had talked about in preview last week, which will end up on this card. It's Carl Roberson taking on Dalcha champ, Dalcha Lunjambula. And I'm really looking forward to that, Matt. But we have a stacked main card on this one. And I mean, it's hard to not say stacked because there's just so many fights. But Pettis Morono, Robertson Santos, Tybura, Greg Hardy, Magic Marlon Moraes taking on Rob Font. You have Michelle Pajeda taking on Chaos Williams and his one-punch knockout power. You have Jose Aldo Jr. in the co-main event taking on Chito Marlon Vera. And Matt, in our main event, Stephen Wonderboy Thompson taking on Jeff Neal. Does any of that take away the sting that we're not going to get Leon Edwards and Hamzat Chimaev?
Okay, so the main event that we were promised was going to deliver, and it was going to be amazing, but I don't really think I can complain about the card that we've been given. I mean, Jeff Neal, he's a guy we haven't been able to see for over a year. No one wants to fight him. That's how good he is. Finally getting a main event spot against Wonderboy, who is kind of the perfect gatekeeper to the elite, if you will. Not that Wonderboy is a gatekeeper, but if you want to get a title shot, you almost have to go through Wonderboy at this point to get there. So, really exciting fight. The return of Jose Aldo, one of the greatest to ever do it. Marlon Moraes, Rob Font, like, this card is going to deliver.
Matt, so let's get into it with our Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen presented by Manscaped. And Matt, as always, the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Use the promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. And Matt, I'm going to talk about my balls a little bit later on in this show so you can get the lowdown on Manscaped. But overall, Matt, we're talking Fight of the Night. We have two fights picked out as we normally do. Now, last weekend, we had Charles Oliveira, Tony Ferguson. Now, didn't really play out as a fight of the night. There were some great fights on that card. Obviously, your main event ended up being an all-timer. And you hate to always pick the main event, but Matt, we got a fight here. Marlon Moraes taking on Rob Font. This one's a great one at 135 pounds. You have a former title challenger in Magic Marlon Moraes. And you look at Rob Font. I mean, this is a guy that fights once in a blue moon. I happen to catch him every now and again on the regional scene in New England. You happen to see him at a New England fights card or what have you, really. He seems to be all over the place. But this guy, it's just unfortunate that we don't get to see Rob Font more often because he's one of the more entertaining talents at 135 pounds.
Oh, 100%. I couldn't be more excited for this fight. People forget, Marlon Moraes should have been fighting for a title after that Jose Aldo fight. Of course, the UFC decided to give Jose Aldo the Piotr Jan fight, and they made Marlon take a long time off. He had a few injuries. Then he comes back against Corey Sandhagen. That fight did not go well for poor Marlon Moraes, but he is still one of the best and most exciting 135ers in the world. And Rob Font's a really interesting fighter because when you give him unranked opponents, he tends to knock them out. But when he himself does fight those top five, top six, top seven guys, that's when he does run into trouble. So I think it's a great opportunity for both guys to get back on track. Because for Marlon, if you beat Rob Font, really tough guy, he still is in the top 15. And it is going to make for an exciting fight that will kind of get your name back into the headlines. And Rob Font, this is the matchup that he has to get over. He's never really been able to beat those next top tier bantamweight. And if he can go out there and finish Marlon or just put on a great performance, he is going to get himself into those. He's not going to fight for a title next, but we could very well see Rob Font in that co-main event or main event slot in the fight night.
And I mean, with a guy like Marlon Moraes, you look at him, and I mean, it's just been a little over 2 months since he lost to Corey Sandhagen. He got finished in that one quickly. You look at his last three fights, too. He gets finished by Cejudo a year and a half ago. He beats Jose Aldo by split decision in a fight that, again, the UFC decided to pass on him for a title shot. And then he loses emphatically against Corey Sandhagen. Is it too early for Marlon Moraes to come back in a spot like this against Rob Font, who, listen, finisher or not, Rob Font has some of the heaviest hands in this division?
I was going to save that for the predictions, but I do think it is a little early, especially if you go back to that fight. Corey Sandhagen points at him and goes, "His orbital's broken." Yeah, if you break your orbital, you probably shouldn't come back 2 months later. So it is a little too soon, but I do think that this is the type of fight that will kind of get Marlon back on track if he is able to win.
And I mean, hey, broken orbitals and all, sometimes for Brandon Moreno, is it broken? Isn't it broken? Maybe that's the game that you play after the card's over and a mat. For me, Jose Aldo Jr. taking on Marlon Vera is my fight of the night. And I look at these guys' track record over their last five. For Jose Aldo, it's a three-fight losing streak, but it's a little bit more complex than that. For Chito Vera, he's 4-1 in his last five. That one loss to Song Yadong in a very competitive fight. I know it could have gone either way. It seems like every Song Yadong fight goes like that. But Yadong really had Marlon Vera's number on that night. For Vera to come back in such a big marquee spot against Sean O'Malley, it was such a shock and surprise to a lot of people that weren't maybe familiar with that Marlon Vera name, for him to pick up such a big finish over such a big name in Sean O'Malley. Again, for Jose Aldo, you look at the last three, the Volkanovski decision's tough. I mean, Volkanovski, an all-timer, the two wins over Holloway after that Aldo win. The loss to Marlon Moraes, which again, split decision loss, it's always tricky there. But his last fight for the title against Piotr Jan, yikes, that one was tough.
I don't remember the specific stat about what the fifth round striking numbers were, but when you start hearing stats about, you know, 75-2 or 80-5, those were the type of numbers that we're dealing with in the Jose Aldo-Piotr Jan fight. And really, up until that point, Jose Aldo was having success. He was doing a really good job against Jan, who I do think Jan is one of those top 10 pound-for-pound guys. And for Jose Aldo to still have a fairly competitive fight with him at this stage in his career is impressive. But for Marlon Vera, this is the ultimate litmus test. You go from Sean O'Malley, someone who, yes, they have more Instagram followers than most other fighters. They have a bigger name than most other fighters. But talent-wise, it is very hard to compare Sean O'Malley at this stage of his career to a Jose Aldo, one of the more accomplished fighters in UFC history. So if Marlon's able to get this win, it not just propels him up the rankings. He's in line for main events. He's going to get a lot more media going forward. And for Jose Aldo, this is your turn to finally be the gatekeeper. He hasn't really had to be the gatekeeper yet. He has always been in that top five situation. He is still in the top five, but this is the first time where we are seeing sort of a diminished level of competition that he will be fighting. So for Aldo, he needs this win because we do a lot of talking about the Dana White 60. If it's four in a row, you never really know what's going to happen.
And I mean, you have a look at Marlon Vera, and to steal a quote from Michael Bisping, he's one of those guys that, you know, chat shit, get banged. And this is one of those fights where it is sink or swim. And for Jose Aldo, definitely the best fighter at featherweight in featherweight history. I mean, it's pretty hard to make an argument. You could say Holloway, you could say whoever you want, but Jose Aldo right up there at the top, WEC legend, UFC legend. The guy has only lost seven fights, and he's only 34 years old, which is crazy to think of. He's been fighting the highest level of competition for what seems like the longest time. And if he loses this fight to Marlon Vera, you're quite low in those rankings, whatever you want to think of them. At one point today, on Monday, Conor McGregor was the top pound-for-pound fighter. A little bit of a mistake on the UFC's part, but either way, this should be a very entertaining fight. The one thing that I'm eager to see in this one, and again, we're going to be breaking it down in full detail later on, but the fact that Marlon Vera has really incorporated a lot of kicks into his arsenal, where for Jose Aldo, he started to get away from them the longer he's gotten in his career. And that's one of those things that definitely worries you. You want him to go back to the way that he fought some of those bigger names in the past. Even the way that he kind of fought against Jeremy Stephens, which seems like it wasn't that long ago, 2.5 years or so ago. But for Jose Aldo, big fight here.
Oh yeah, 100%. This, again, he's not at the Junior Dos Santos level of a losing streak. It's not like he's getting brutally finished in all of his fights. But after that Jan fight at 34, it's not like Jose Aldo's been, you know, squeaky clean throughout his whole career. He has taken some damage, so it will be interesting to see what version of Aldo we get.
Matt, really looking forward to this. And again, the fight of the night screen in the entire show presented to you by Manscaped. Who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming? Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Use the promo code FNP for 20% off your order and free shipping at manscaped.com. Again, 20% off. Promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. And Matt, overall, really looking forward to this card. You got Wonderboy Thompson, Jeff Neal in the main event, but we have 15 fights total. It's a busy one. I've seen a lot of people just kind of passing off on this card, just maybe skimming through it. We're going down and dirty. We did the tape study for this one. I'm really looking forward to this card, Matt. So as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. First fight on our card this weekend, UFC Vegas 17 coming at us from the UFC's Apex facility in Las Vegas, Nevada. Matt, they built a $100 million facility to put on fights like this, and this is the return. And I've been calling for this guy's return. Matt, I'm a weird guy. I like a lot of weird fighters. Rick Glenn is one of my guys. And Matt, I know the narrative going into this fight, and there's a lot of people that are going to tell you, well, hey, you saw how good Gavin Tucker looked last weekend. Rick Glenn beat the piss out of Gavin Tucker. You're picking Rick Glenn in this fight. And Matt, we'll get into our picks later on, as we always do. You got to give both guys a shot. But Matt, Rick Glenn, and I had to write it in the old paper notes, he will have been away from the octagon for 750 total days before he comes back to take on Carlton Minus. Matt, Rick Glenn's last fight didn't go all that well. He took on Kevin Aguilar, longtime LFA vet, former champ, a guy that's fought a who's who of not just regional talent, but guys that have come into some of the biggest organizations we've seen. And Kevin Aguilar took that fight 30-27. All three of the judges scored it that way. He earned a knockdown in the last round against Rick Glenn. Glenn didn't look all that great. And the reason why Rick Glenn's been away for so long, and I had to really reach out and talk to a lot of different people, so credit where credit is due.
With Chris Connor from Last Call with Chris Connor.
I had to send him a message because I put it out there. I was looking forward to this card. There's 15 fights on it. And then my sentence under it was, and it is a return of Rick Glenn. And I cannot oversell or undersell how excited I am to see Rick Glenn back. It's not that I don't like Carlton Minus. I just really like Rick Glenn. So Chris kind of commented under it, and I really get the backstory as to why Rick Glenn's been away. And he's no longer with Team Alpha Male, which a lot of sites might still have him listed as. He moved back up to Iowa, took a job as a plumber. He had a lot of nagging hip issues, so he got that taken care of, a lot of different surgeries. And that's really why he's been out for so long. So Rick Glenn finally healed up. He's been away for about 2 years. The thing that I do like for a guy like this, he's had a lot of miles on him. I mean, the guy's had 28 professional fights. He's only 31 years old. So he's at that weird spot where, okay, do I take the time away? Do I focus on my family? I know him and his wife have a kid on the way coming up early spring, late winter. So congrats to the Rick Glenn clan. But another thing, you know, the guy's 31, 32. You're entering your physical prime at this age. But you've had so many fights. I mean, this guy, former World Series of Fighting featherweight champ, beat Georgie Karhanian, another one of my guys, and then would end up losing in his next fight to Lance Palmer, the $2 million man with PFL. But Rick Glenn, he's been away for so long, so you don't really know what you're going to get. He's not training a Team Alpha Male, kind of went back home, so to speak. Do you think that that's going to help him that time off?
So it is really interesting, and I think it will, but I also think it will be a detriment as well. Because for a guy like Rick Glenn, timing is a big part of his game because he is so well-rounded. Rick Glenn's not a guy who can just go out there and rely on the one big shot that knocks you out. He will have to set up his strikes, and I do think it's going to take him, maybe not rounds, but it will take him minutes to kind of get back into the flow of things. Because with Rick Glenn, he throws combos very similar to a Tim Means, for instance, where once he does get things going, it's just like a boulder rolling down a hill. It is really hard to get him to stop. And when he is going body head, throwing in leg kicks, he's a very difficult fighter to deal with. So I think for the timing alone, it might take him a little bit of time to get back into it. But I do like what you said about he is a really active guy. Rick Glenn fights do tend to be very entertaining fights. He does take some damage. So the time off should help him overall. I'm just curious as to sort of the intricacies of his game, if you will, if it will affect those at all. But for Carlton Minus, I think this is the perfect opponent to come back to for Rick Glenn. Because with Minus, he's not going to go out there and just blow the doors off you with his wrestling or just with his striking. He will show you a lot of different looks. And for Rick Glenn, I think that's really important for his comeback fight. Because if he does go out there, and if we do see the Rick Glenn that we're used to at 145, he's just 10 pounds heavier, he should be able to get this win. He's a more technical guy in the feet. I like him off his back too, and I like his ability to get back up to his feet if he is taken down. But if we do see a reduced version of Rick Glenn, I'm really curious as to what Carlton Minus can do to take advantage of the ring rust, of those timing issues that Rick Glenn might have.
Because with Carlton Minus, and we talked about this before his UFC debut against Matt Semelsberger, and it was one of those weird fights, and not a knock on you, I remember that fight vividly, getting ready for it, because we like to talk about these men and women that are making their UFC debuts. It's an exciting thing for us. We like doing the research. So for Carlton Minus, I went back and watched as much tape as I could from Alaska FC. And you get some weird competition there. I know in the original prediction video, we talked about the records of some of the guys. Like, it was just absolute dust. And then he gets a win over Justin Buchholz, which is kind of a big deal. That was 2.5 years ago because Justin Buchholz at a time was one of the big coaches at Team Alpha Male. So Rick Glenn, a little bit of familiarity there. So Minas gets a shot with the PFL. And they don't just match him up against anybody. They match him up against Rick Story. And listen, Donald Cerrone took his soul. But apart from that, Rick Story, pretty complete fighter.
Gunnar Nelson in a UFC main event. No one can ever take that away from him.
Pretty good fighter. He beat the absolute shit out of poor Carlton Minas. So Minas goes home, back to Alaska FC, picks up a win over Sean Ellis, who's 12-3, whose record made no sense whatsoever. Gets a nice decision win there about 9 months ago. Gets a call up against Matt Semmelsberger. And I remember saying, Semmelsberger, he was a strong safety in university. He trains out of a weird gym. He's a power guy. He can wrestle. And with Carlton Minas going into that fight, he's just a busy guy on the feet. That's kind of his thing. He does a little bit of the Darren Till in and out stuff. He really throws a lot of feints. He'll toss a jab out there. He'll throw a straight right. But apart from that, Carlton Minas doesn't really do a whole lot. I mean, I know he trains out of Avalanche Wrestling up there in Anchorage, which is cool because you don't have a lot of people from Anchorage fighting in the UFC, let alone a lot of the professional sports. I mean, the only big Alaskan sports star that I can think of off the top of my head. Well, I was thinking of Scott Gomez.
There you go.
Scott Gomez, Stanley Cup champion. So there's that. But I look at this fight as, yeah, Carlton Minas, he's got to be busy enough to really try and break up the game plan of Rick Glenn. And for Rick Glenn, a guy coming off that long of a layoff, the hip issues and whatnot, he's got to kind of just make it a slow burn type of fight and really try to wear on Carlton Minas.
I agree. And for Rick Glenn, I do think his most underrated attribute is his wrestling. Because when you think of Rick Glenn, he is more of a traditional striker. He likes to stay at range. He does use his combos. His offensive wrestling actually is quite good. So if he does get in trouble on the feet, if he is fighting someone who does have a power advantage over himself, look for him to incorporate some of his takedowns. He has really nice trip takedowns from the clinch too. Just a bit of an X factor that I don't feel like it's talked about enough with Rick Glenn.
So Matt, if we talk about this fight in terms of the predictions, over on Tapology, 658 total votes, 86% going with Rick Glenn, 85% pick him to win a decision. If we have a look at the odds, a little bit of a surprise because, again, everybody in the corner of Rick Glenn, he opened a minus 240, he's now at a minus 337 on best fight odds. If we have a look at Carlton Minas, open a plus 205, he's now at a plus 261. Rick Glenn, one of the bigger movers and shakers on the card, at about a 29% clip over there on that site. I'm a little bit surprised by that. To me, this isn't even a parlay piece because, again, you don't know exactly what you're going to get out of Rick Glenn. We've seen major sports stars and we've seen especially fighters going through hip surgeries. Now, Dustin Poirier, little bit of an outlier because at the top of this division, he had the hip surgeries. He came back in, fought Dan Hooker, looked pretty damn good.
It was an all right fight.
Threw a lot of kicks too, so there is that. But with Rick Glenn, I just don't know. He's moving up from 45 to 55 for this fight. For Carlton Minas, you look it up, he hasn't fought at lightweight in 5 or 6 years. It's been a long time. He's had most of his fights at welterweight. He's even had a few at middleweight as well. So a little bit of a surprise for Carlton Minas. I'm not too worried about him making the weight. But again, he just fought at welterweight 3 months ago. So we'll see how he makes out in this one. Rick Glenn moving up. Overall, I'm going with Rick Glenn. But again, you can't go off of that damn Gavin Tucker fight. I don't care what anybody tells you. That fight was so long ago. Both guys are different fighters from then. And I mean, for Rick Glenn, he ended up losing to Miles Jury quite soundly. And then he beat Dennis Bermudez by split decision. So it'll be interesting to see what we get out of both guys. I'll stick with the pick of Rick Glenn in this one. But overall, I am really looking forward to this fight.
Oh, 100%. I like what you had said, too. Don't add this to a parlay piece. Because we don't know what version of Rick Glenn we're going to get. New weight class, new hip, new man, hopefully. So I do think he's going to be able to get it done against Carlton Minas, but we're going to learn a lot from both guys in this fight. If Rick Glenn can go out there, have an impressive performance, maybe he can string together some nice wins at 155, so we'll see what we get.
We're hoping this isn't your grandparents' titanium hip, and we're going with the pick of Rick Glenn, the Gladiator. Matt, really looking forward to this card. UFC Vegas 17 from the Apex facility. We got a main event between Wonder Boy and Jeff Neal. That's the last time I'll sing that on this. I'm really looking forward to it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
With the UFC debut of The Brick, Jimmy Flick taking on Cody Durden. And Matt, Cody Durden debuted back earlier on this year on very short notice, replacing Luke Sanders, taking on now a former common opponent between these two guys in Chris Gutierrez, up a weight class at 135 pounds. Now, for Cody Durden, he had spent a large majority of his career at bantamweight. Now, I know if you go through his record on Tapology, there's a lot of catchweight fights peppered in there between 127 and 130 pounds. A little bit of a head scratcher, kind of worrisome. And Cody Durden, so far throughout his career, has had one fight at flyweight. He lost that fight at flyweight. That is one of his two losses in his career. But for what it's worth, in Cody Durden's UFC debut, performed admirably there. Earned a draw against Chris Gutierrez, who was coming off of a wild win. Leg kick TKO. So he goes into the fight against Durden, and it was a weird one. Because for Gutierrez, you're originally going to be taking on Luke Sanders. What's Luke Sanders other than a glass cannon? He's a bit of a jack of all trades. He can do a lot of things very well. I don't know if Gutierrez kind of underestimated the short notice opponent in Durden. But he lost that first round handily. All three judges scored it a 10-8 for Cody Durden. All three judges scored the remaining two rounds 10-9s for Gutierrez. Overall, a draw. So for Durden, he looked great. For Gutierrez, bit of a head scratcher. So for Durden moving forward, we know him as a wrestler. We know him as that classic wrestle boxer, guy that's going to kind of crash forward, look for the takedown, look for top control, smash that ground and pound. If he can get a submission, kudos to him. He's a guy that trains at an American Top Team Atlanta. Now, I know on some sites they have him as ATT, and then they list the training partners as the Amanda Nunes, the Dustin Poirier's of the world. He's an ATT Atlanta guy. Who trains out of ATT Atlanta? Well, the Lima brothers. You've got Rafael Assuncao. You've got Ill Will Brooks, former Bellator champ. There are a lot of good fighters there, but you have to make the distinction between the two. For Jimmy Flick coming in here, making his UFC debut, this is a guy that has so many wins by submission. It's kind of a bit of a head scratcher when you look at his record. And you talk about some of the losses that he has so far in his career. UFC caliber fighters. Ray Rodriguez, his last loss. Before that, Chris Gutierrez. And we can go down through the list. Levi Mowles, another one of those losses. But those are all pretty high level opponents. Now, the wins, maybe not the highest of caliber. But when you look at a guy's record, being a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, having 13 of 15 pro wins by submission, very, very, you know, important, especially going into a fight like this, because as far as styles, and styles always make fights, this makes for a very interesting fight. I would almost consider it like a B grade when you compare this to Nate Landwehr, Movsar Evloev. Yeah, but this is still a really good fight. I'm really looking forward to it. I don't know if both guys stick at 25, if this is maybe a one-off, that remains to be seen, but I'm really looking forward to this one.
So am I. Now, hashtag flyweight never die. It is always nice seeing the UFC bring in more flyweight talent, or just have more guys in the flyweight division, because you know that, well, for the 13 fighters there, they need new opponents at a certain point, and I do think both guys will be compelling matchups for some of the other guys in the division if they do choose to stay down at 125. This fight is kind of odd, though, because I can see it going two completely different ways. We're either going to get a really fun scramble fest between these two guys, or it's going to be one of those Kamaru Usman, Colby Covington fights where it's okay, we're both so good at grappling that it's going to force the stand-up out of the two of us. Now, for Cody Durden, he is definitely the more powerful out of these two guys. On the feet, Jimmy Flick will give you a lot of different looks. He's not afraid to throw the calf kick. He's not afraid to go to the body with his kicks either. The thing about him, though, and especially the fact that Cody Durden is such a good wrestler, I'm a little worried that if Flick does get a little carried away with some of those kicks, Durden could catch them, and then that just makes the takedown attempt so much easier for him. And once this fight hits the mat, that's where the real fun starts, because Flick, when you say 13 of his 15 wins have come by submission, that's not even doing it justice. It's not like he's just getting arm bars or he's just getting chokes. You look at this man's record, anaconda submissions, Darce chokes, rear naked chokes. He really doesn't discriminate, and he is a threat no matter where the fight takes place on the mat. And for Cody Durden, his fight against Gutierrez, I like that we saw just a little bit of everything from him. We saw how good his grappling can be when he's on the offensive. We saw some of the holes in his striking game. We did see his cardio start to fade. But again, Chris Gutierrez is a very good UFC caliber fighter. So having a draw with a guy like that, there's no shame in that. But I do like that we just saw a lot of Cody Durden in that fight. Durden on top is going to be a huge threat for Flick. And Flick can't get into that, and we talk about this all the time, he can't get into that Louis Smolka where he's on his back, he is the comfortable grappler off his back, trying to go for submissions that he's not getting, because Cody Durden will rain down ground and pound on him, and it is hellacious. Now, the thing about Cody Durden, he creates a lot of space, and that can open some submission threats for Jimmy Flick off of his back. So I do think that this could be one of those, you know, Cody Durden getting a lot of takedowns throughout the fight, and then Flick potentially getting the submission as the fight goes on. But it's just that this fight and these two athletes match up so well together that I don't really care where the fight takes place, because it should be exciting no matter what.
Jimmy Flick gets hit. And it's not to say that Cody Durden doesn't, but if you go back and watch that fight against Ray Rodriguez, they exchange. Rodriguez, a much better striker. Now, I know his short notice UFC debut Didn't go very well for Ray Rodriguez. It went the way of Jimmy Flick against Ray Rodriguez. But in that one, they get into a clinch position, or if they even got in close, Rodriguez would start popping up with the knees, hit Flick hard, followed it up, finished him in that one. Now, Flick obviously on a win streak since then, really tied things together. In 2020, he became the freestyle cage fighting flyweight champion. It's hard to say without laughing. That's a silly name for an organization. He also became the LFA flyweight champ, for what that's worth. And he came in on short notice, replacing JP Baez to take on Nate Smith, on Dana White's Contender Series Week 5 this year, earn a contract, and now he gets to face off against Cody Durden. Like I said, Durden, the one fight at flyweight, all those weird catchweight bouts, so maybe the weight cut could be an issue. I know weighed in at a healthy 135.5, again, that on short notice, taking on Gutierrez. And I remember watching back that prediction video to kind of try and get a little bit more intel on Cody Durden. The fact that at that time, we weren't sure if that fight was going to take place at 35 or 45. So a lot of question marks around this fight. You look at it, and I mean, we talk about Cody Durden. He can crash forward. It's kind of a similar game plan to a lot of those wrestle boxers. We got another one on this card, like a Justin James. He can always rely on his wrestling. He doesn't. He's more than capable of brawling. Cody Durden can do that as well. Went 2 of 13 of his overall takedown attempts against Chris Gutierrez. But again, Gutierrez is a pretty good fighter. Has a win over Flick, like we had said. If we have a look at the odds for this fight, Matt, I was a little bit surprised. Flick opened on minus 222 average on best fight odds. He's now minus 177 for Durden. Opened up a plus 183. He's now at a plus 146. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, limited sample size, but at a 677 total votes. 82% going Flick, 70% going Flick by submission. That's the sexy pick. I mean, that's kind of been the story of his career. What's your take on this one overall?
So I really do think this fight comes down to cardio more than anything else. Because with Cody Durden, you see at the start of a fight, if he is able to get it to the ground, he is a big guy, especially for this weight class, and he's extremely explosive. And if he's able to get the back of Jimmy Flick, I don't care how good of a grappler Jimmy Flick is, just the added physicality of Cody Durden is going to give him problems throughout this fight. As the fight progresses, though, I do see Jimmy Flick kind of fighting his way back into it. And here's the really important thing, too. If Cody Durden gets the takedown, Jimmy Flick isn't completely out of the fight. If Jimmy Flick is able to get on top of Cody Durden, that's by far the most dangerous position for either guy in this fight. Because if Flick is the one on top, he's going to be able to threaten with arm bars and chokes. And he's really going to force Durden to be uncomfortable off of his back. So it comes down to, can Cody Durden get enough takedowns and at least get enough damage early on in the fight so to where Jimmy Flick's, I'll say, cardio advantage doesn't really kick into play in, you know, late second, early third round? I'm saying Jimmy Flick is going to win by submission. Not my most confident pick. I do think this will be a really fun fight, though.
It is a really tough one to gauge because you look at Cody Durden's career that he had with NFC and the regional scene in the U.S. Southeast. Good career. I mean, in one night, he won a boxing fight, he won a kickboxing fight, and he won an MMA
fight.
Which
is wild.
It is wild, and he can be a jack of all trades. I just really worry, what's the ceiling with Cody Durden? He had a really good fight against Chris Gutierrez. Now we're popping down to 125, where we're 0-1 in our career, and we have 13 pro fights. Why? Like, it's just, maybe it's a path of least resistance to get to the top, and this is the perfect fight for him to take. And you know what? I'd be somewhat in agreement. I think you fight a guy like Jimmy Flick that has 20 pro fights, all of them but one on the regional scene, or call Dana White's Contender Series, whatever you want. Maybe all 20 on the regional scene. And he's had good results. The one thing that I worry about for Jimmy Flick going forward, four of his total losses are by knockout. That's not a great sign. I really don't love the stand-up that he has. Now, in the Nate Smith fight, yeah, he looked good. He looked really good. He was throwing those nice hooks. He was closing distance well. And when he needed to, he could slap that calf kick, and it was hot and heavy. It was very well timed, too. He caught Smith almost flat-footed at times, and that's when those calf kicks really do most of their damage. And he switches stance really well, too. I just don't know if he's going to have the time to do it against a guy like Durden that's really trying to close that gap at all points.
No, all those points are really fair, and I do like what you brought up. Flick and Durden will have to make some adjustments to their styles if they do plan on staying at the flyweight division, because this isn't the flyweight division from 2015 where there wasn't a lot of guys who could go out there and get the knockout. Right now at flyweight, Figueiredo can knock you out, Pantoja can knock you out, Askar Askarov hits really hard. Like, there's so many good finishers at this weight class who aren't going to fall for the, you know, kind of one-trick pony-ish if you don't get taken down by Jimmy Flick, or if Cody Gooden can't take you down, those upper elite guys are going to kind of have their way with both these guys. So I will be interested to see both careers moving forward. But yeah, I still have Flick.
And I mean, to offer up the final pick, because I've tried to go both ways with it, I do like Jimmy Flick ever so slightly in this fight. Again, he's going to be fishing for submissions constantly. Cody Gooden, again, with that forward pressure, maybe looking for the takedowns. Now, is he going to be able to be taken down? Will Jimmy Flick be able to inflict the takedown on him? I don't totally know that one. But again, in those clinch positions, definitely dangerous. Cody Gooden could certainly catch Jimmy Flick with a dirty, nasty shot. We've seen it in his fights as well. But I'm leaning ever so slightly to Flick. I do not like these odds.
Not
the fact that Flick opened an average minus 222... He hasn't fought the right level of competition to the way where, you know, you get 20 pro fights. I would expect some of those wins to be some big names. There are none. The losses are to bigger regional names, but the wins aren't. So I kind of worry about that a little bit, where Cody Gooden faced that good competition. Again, now you're playing MMA math because Flick lost to Gutierrez by finish in the third round. Gooden, you know, had a draw and had a competitive, an incredibly competitive first round. So it is a tough one to call. I can certainly see people going either way. The Tapology voters going with Flick, the odds going with Flick. We're both going with Flick.
Ever so slightly.
Probably one of the least confident picks on the card, but I am really looking forward to this fight, Matt, because hey, sky's the limit. You never know, especially in this flyweight division. So we're both going with Jimmy Flick in this fight to get the win. Really looking forward to this card. Really excited for this fight, and low-key, I haven't done this much tape study in a really long time. I'm very excited for this fight. At middleweight, we have Tafon Dodonchukwue representing Cameroon, taking on Jamie Pickett, the Night Wolf. Pickett coming out of Wilmington, North Carolina. And listen, I say Wilmington, but he's really from a small town that doesn't even have a stoplight. I heard that in an interview he did with TJ DeSantis and Dean Thomas, and this guy's last fight in Jamie Pickett was absolutely insane over on Dana White's Contender Series. It was his third opportunity on the show. And you know what they say? Third time's a charm. He got a big win over Jonathan Patti, where he threw a 20-punch combo like Mortal Kombat and knocked him out. And it was absolutely insane. Again, the other two appearances on Dana White's Contender Series, 2017 and 2019. In 2017, he lost by submission to Charles Byrd, no longer in the UFC. In 2019, he lost a lopsided decision to Punahele Soriano. And the last time I checked, Puna Soriano is pretty darn good at middleweight. So for Mr. Jamie Pickett, I mean, really good striker. He'll mix in the leg kick. He can wrestle a little bit. But when he puts that pressure on, and there's other fighters that kind of fight similar to him on this card, and I'll talk about them the further along we get along. But you know when Chris Daukaus does the thing at heavyweight, when he crashes forward and throws those hooks, that's kind of the way that Jamie Pickett really initiates his offense. Ayman Zahabi's another one of those fighters that when he presses forward and crashes forward, he finds a lot of success in the violence, and that sounds like something a fellow Canadian Robin Black would say. But for
sick.
Jamie Pickett, that's kind of the key to success. For Tafon Chukwue, I watched all four of his pro fights. I watched some of the Muay Thai fights because he's 13-1 in Muay Thai. He has a kickboxing background. Dana White compared him a little bit to Mike Tyson after he got his win over on Contender Series this past summer. The win over Al Matavao in a fight where, if you're a big Jamie Pickett fan, you want to find some pointers as to a way to beat Tafon Chukwue. It's just land volume, land kicks, and do not try to wrestle him. Because I looked at Tafon Chukwue and I figured, well, okay, this guy has a Muay Thai and kickboxing background. He stands really heavy and he throws a lot of power shots. Just wrestle him. It's going to be that easy. All right, you'd think it was that easy, right? So I went back and watched those four fights. His fight against Myers in his pro debut, he stuffed all 8 takedowns and knocked him out with a left straight. Knocked him completely, it hit him clean in the forehead, knocked him straight down. In his second pro fight, he took on A.T. McCowan. You go back and watch that one, no takedown attempts, they clinch up a little bit, and Chukwue lands a knee and knocks him out. Then you go in, you watch the fight against William Knight. William Knight went, and I scored it 0-5 on takedown attempts. William Knight's a big guy. That fight was at a cruiserweight. So that's the other part of this. Chukwue's fought at heavyweight, cruiserweight, and then he weighed in at 204 pounds for his last fight on Contender Series, so lightweight. This fight's at middleweight. Tafon Chukwe is one of those guys that as he moves down in weight classes, you're losing that muscle mass. Now, we've seen fighters do it before. We've seen them move up. We've seen them move down with, you know, varying success. I'm interested to see how Chukwe makes out in this one, because from what I've seen, his kicks are insane. And you talk about Muay Thai fighters in MMA, you either have a ton of success or you don't. You can either be Loma Lukbunmi or you can be Rafael Fiziev. To me, if Chukwe threw a little bit more volume, maybe he'd be more similar to Fiziev. But right now, he is such a force, such a power puncher. That knockout that he had over Al Matava was absolutely insane. Matt, I've talked a lot about this fight, but I've spent hours in tape study on this one. I'm really looking forward to it. What are your thoughts on this one?
I gotta be honest, I can't add that much more to your breakdown over it. Jamie Pickett's not gonna win this fight, and these are the reasons why. When you look at Tafon and Chukwu's striking, he is at such a high level, and John Franklin, gonna plug the post-fight show, he brought up a really good point about Rafael Fiziev, and he said that, why do we not give striking the sort of depth to it that we give grappling? Because with grappling, it's always, oh, it's so pristine and there's so many different things going on. With strikers like the Tafon and Chukwus, with the Israel Adesanyas, with the Rafael Fiziev, they do look at striking a different way, and he can set up his strikes like not a lot of guys at middleweight can. And with a guy like Jimmy Pickett, he does get a little wild with his shots, and we're going to bring this up later. Jeff Neal, when he has someone hurt, is perfect at finishing them. He doesn't get too wild. He doesn't just try to burn himself out going for the finish. He stays technical, and he does what got him to getting his opponent hurt in the first place. With Jamie Pickett, if he does hurt his opponent, I hate to use this term, but he just bum rushes them and throws everything he can. So for Tafon Chukwe, I do think that the volume will be an issue, but I don't think a guy like Jamie Pickett will be able to use that against him this early on in his career. As he does move up the ranks and we do start to see him fight, you know, the Antonio Carlos Juniors, if you will, sort of the guys who aren't elite in the division but can offer him a lot of different looks, I do think he will struggle, but I like how the UFC has chosen to matchmake him early on. He is a phenomenal striker. He does have the really good takedown defense as well, and I just don't really see what Jamie Pickett can do to really take Tafon off his game.
That's the thing. I mean, for Tafon in his first pro fight, again, to go back to the Alex Myers fight, you watch it and you think, well, again, maybe he's going to gas himself out. You have all these takedown attempts from Myers and Chukwe. The one nice thing that he really does is when he gets posted up against the cage, he'll always work his way out of it. He either reverses his opponent or just completely gets out of it. He does a great job. You'd be surprised, to steal a term from, and I never thought I would, from Brendan Schaub, so apologies where they're due. But again, for a guy that's 4-0, it was kind of interesting to listen to Dana White after that episode of Contender Series, because he basically said, normally I give a guy like this a developmental deal, like they did with William Knight, and Chukwe decided to say bye-bye William Knight, even though he made his way back. But Dana White was like, yeah, he scared me. That was one of the craziest knockouts I've ever seen, so on and so forth. Well, let's be honest. It wasn't one of the craziest knockouts I've ever seen.
It was nice.
It was cool. It was great. And it earned him a shot at the dance. I think he might struggle, but he's coming out of a camp where, you know, Lloyd Irvin's martial arts, say what you will, but Sadiq Yusuf is a great guy to train with. I know totally different weight classes, but it seems like they pal around quite a bit. That's a good guy. They do have some good training partners there. And Matt, out of the Tapology picks, 670, we'll call it, 85% going with Chukwe, 88% having to win by knockout. If we have a look at the odds, Chukwe is a -312 favorite, open to -256. For Jamie Pickett, open to +205. He's now a +246. So a lot of people are riding with Tafon Chukwe in his UFC debut. The one thing with Jamie Pickett, again, the volume could really help him. If he really presses forward and hopefully he doesn't get caught by a shot, you never know, he could have success. He does tend to get backed up and he leaves his chin quite high. You never like to see that. I like Tafon Chukwe in this fight. I'm really looking forward to it. But yeah, again, the weight's one of the concerns. Again, from low 200s at heavyweight to then 204 at 205, and now to move down to middleweight. I'll be eager to see him on the scales, so it's one of those ones where you probably want to tune into Question Mark Kicks so we can get an accurate assessment of these guys after weigh-in day. But right now, here on Monday, definitely going with Cameroon's Tafon Chukwe.
So for Jamie Pickett, it will be interesting to see kind of how he deals with the power of Tafon, because he is going to have to close that distance at some point, but every time he does go to do so, he's going to be put right into the fire. And if he does eat one of those big shots, I really doubt he's going to be able to eat it. So I've got Tafon all day.
Matt, really looking forward to this fight. Both of us going with Tafon Chukwe to get the win in his UFC debut. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fighting Picks, Matt, because we have not one, not five, not 10. We have 15 fights on this card to break down. So as we always say, Matt, with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. really looking forward to our next fight at Bantamweight. And we have a UFC debut for Draco the Great Dracolini, or Dracolini Rodriguez, taking on Ayman Zahabi. Matt, for Ayman Zahabi, it has been a minute since we've seen him in the UFC. And I had to go back and watch all of the UFC tape on him because, hey, it's been, what, 4 years, almost 5 years since he was on the regional scene. And for Ayman Zahabi on the Canadian regional scene, went 6-0, all six wins by first-round finish, three of them by knockout, three of them by submission. At a time, he was a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. He's since upgraded. He's a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And in the three UFC fights, it just so happened, Matt, that we were there for his UFC debut in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Brian Stann, Todd Grisham on the call for that one. And in that fight, Ayman Zahabi, it was a really good fight. It was against Vieira. And with Reginaldo Vieira, he won the Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 4. I know he got knocked out in the quarterfinals, came back, won. And he had this fight against Zahabi where they really marketed the Canadian, the fact that his brother's, of course, Faraz from TriStar. He's a really technical fighter. And if you go back and watch that fight, when Zahabi had his most success, it was crashing forward. It was always setting things up with his left leg when he's from the orthodox stance. He'll switch to southpaw, but the weird thing is he doesn't throw a lot when he goes southpaw. It's almost to just close distance and offer a different look, but it's not like he really pumps the jab out there. It does a whole lot with it. It's just to throw something different. So in that fight against Vieira, he wins it. I had scored at 29-27 for Zahabi. Then you look at his next fight, UFC 217 on the prelims, taking on Ricardo Ramos. And Matt, you think about that fight, you think about the finish. But before that, Zahabi was having a lot of success in that fight.
It is always odd when you look at a fighter and you try to think, okay, where did they fight their best fight? Well, for Ayman Zahabi, he fought his best fight in a loss. And not just a loss. It was one of the more vicious knockout losses you'll ever see. Because he gets, like, double spinning elbowed. Not something you see all that often in the UFC. It was very strange, though. When Ayman Zahabi fights like he's playing Dance Dance Revolution, his feet never stop moving. He is always doing something with his feet, whether that is switching stances. He does do a lot of in-and-out movement. Not exactly like a Dominic Cruz, but he does try to send you a lot of feints, and he doesn't always throw punches to do so. In the Ramos fight, he did well on the feet. He was doing really good clinch work. And the real key for Ayman Zahabi is when he lets his combinations go, he does have really good success. Because we saw it kind of similar to a Gavin Tucker last weekend, where when he was throwing in combination, he was having a lot of success. Maybe the first two would land on the arms, but then that would open up the third strike. And with Ayman, he has a very similar game plan where he is going to dart in, throw his combination, try to get out of distance. He can get caught, though, and we have seen that before. Sometimes he will try to extend the combination if he thinks he is landing well, and he is susceptible to the counter on that, and that worries me a little bit against a guy like Draco Rodriguez, who does have big power at this weight class. And for Zahabi as well, just last point, he is good at wrestling, but I wish he did more of it. Again, we talk about his jiu-jitsu credentials. It's not like he's a fighter who goes out there and really tries to get the fight to the mat constantly. If it does end up there, he is more than happy to oblige. But it's very odd that a guy who does have such a good grappling acumen doesn't actively use it in more MMA fights.
I think Draco Rodriguez is going to bring it to him in that way. And that's why I think this fight is a lot more competitive than the odds. And then at the same time, you look at Zahabi. He's been off for, what, almost a year and a half? And that's the thing. You look at his, his pro career so far. One fight in 2012, two in 2014, two in 2015. Then he fights once in 2016, twice in 2017, then 2019, then 2020. It's been a lot of inactivity. And I went back and read an article and a bit of an interview that he did with Al Deas up here in Canada, which is the French language arm of TSN, which is our Canadian version of ESPN, to make that complicated for anybody that's not a Canadian or French language speaker. But the crux of the interview that he did was the fact that, A, it sucks that I've been off for so long. B, I'm on the call sheet and I keep accepting fights, but guys turn me away. And he's not really in a position to take fights because he's lost two in a row. And the other thing about Ayman Zahabi is that, and they've said this on broadcast before, he's the type of guy, and we talked about this with Adrian Yanez, so same division, last week on This Week in MMA. Hey, do you watch a lot of tape on your opponents or do you trust the coaches? And he's like, well, I was on the regional scene, so there wasn't a lot of tape, but now I'm going to watch more of it, and I really incorporate it into the game plan with my coaches. For Zahabi, he's one of those guys that goes out and does a ton of film study, and it's almost like he over-prepares for fights, and I think that's a trouble of, well, my brother's Faraz, and I stay at the gym, and he talked about this in the interview too. Well, I make money during the day because I'm associated with the gym, so fighting's just kind of like out there. I wish I could fight more, but at the end of the day, I've got the gym. for Draco Rodriguez coming in here, this was a guy that got passed over, and I remember this story. At UFC 239, he was supposed to come in on short notice and take on Chito Vera, and King of the Cage wouldn't release him from his contract.
Unfortunate.
It was after he had fought Tony Gravely for the belt and had lost. It was after he got a win there. I want to say that was January 2019. And then he was looking forward to taking the fight against Chito on short notice. He was originally booked for a King of the Cage main event against Johnny Munoz Jr., who ended up in the UFC as well. That fight fell through. Then he ended up, he had one more fight with King of the Cage. At the time, the promoter and co-owner said, well, he's got four fights left in his contract. I know what the promoter is actually trying to do, and it's kind of weird, and you might not agree with me here, but Draco Rodriguez is young. I mean, the guy's only, what, 24 years old? The promoter wanted him to kind of grow in the promotion where he didn't have to take a fight way too soon. And I get it, but at the same time, if you're Draco Rodriguez, you're going to petition hard for that UFC debut. Unfortunately, he had to wait. He ended up taking a fight on Dana White's Contender Series this summer against Mauna Martinez. Got a first-round triangle choke. It was a wild fight. It was a fight that was pick'em odds. But I went back and watched a ton of Draco Rodriguez tape for this one. This guy's wild as f***. Like, you look at six of his seven wins are by finish. He has a 13-0 amateur record, which is insane. That's too much of an amateur career, if you ask me. That started when he was 19. And the fact that he has all these armbar wins, armbar, triangle choke, guillotine, what else? His first pro fight, another guillotine. He was a white belt in 2018. It's crazy how aggressive he fights. Now, the level of competition is a bit of an issue. Again, Mauna Martinez getting that win was a big deal. So credit where credit's due. And that has to happen. When you're a guy in the regional scene, you're beating the guys you should beat. Then you go up on the big scene. You get a win like that on Contender Series. You get a contract. He deserved it. Kudos to him. UFC fans and you know, prospect fans have had their eyes on Draco Rodriguez for a while. I got to talk about that Tony Gravely fight, though.
Gravely!
King of the Cage, territorial conflict back in 2018. He gets beat pillar to post by Tony Gravely. And listen, Tony Gravely's a good fighter. That was his last fight with King of the Cage. Then he went and dominated CES. Then he ended up in the UFC. But when he had that fight, his takedown defense wasn't great. He was fishing for submissions, but he got beaten on the ground all five rounds until he got finished at the end of the fifth. I worry about that a little bit, and he's still a little green, but overall, this guy's such a good prospect. His hands are great. His aggressiveness is awesome, and he doesn't give a damn about what belt color you have in jiu-jitsu. He is going to go full bore, balls to the wall, and that should make for a really interesting fight here against Zahabi.
Okay, I don't know if we can take a lot from the Gravely loss, because just Gravely doesn't fight at all like Ayman Zahabi. Gravely is a much more dominant wrestler than Ayman Zahabi, and again, I would love it if Ayman Zahabi fought like Tony Gravely. He probably had a ton of success because he is so good on the ground, but he's one of these guys who, I don't want to say he's fallen in love with his hands, but he is much more happy to get into a striking exchange than he is in the grappling, and it is a very curious case when you do have a guy who, belt-wise, he might not be as good as Ayman Zahabi, but in MMA, his grappling, I would say, at least rivals it, if not better, because he uses it a lot more. So I am very excited for if this fight does hit the mat. I'm really curious to see who has the advantage. The inactivity of Ayman Zahabi does really worry me. I would like to see him compete quite a bit more. He's a young guy who is improving, so it would be nice if he could get in there a little bit more often. I know he is, and you had mentioned it, he is kind of in that James Krause level where it's like, okay, I'm making money being a coach at a gym. Fighting's not the most important thing to me, but I still do like doing it. For Zahabi, it's just one of those things. If he was more active, I do think we would see more progression between every fight for him. And this fight is really hard to pick. I know you've got the odds up. They are quite close.
They're not really close. Sorry. They're stupid. So Draco Rodriguez opened a minus 185 favorite. That line dropped just about last week, early last week. He was a minus 230 at one point. It's coming back up. So right now he's minus 193. If we have a look at Ayman Zahabi, he opened a plus 160, went up as high as a plus 186. He's now at a plus 160 again. That line's moved all day towards Ayman Zahabi. If we look at the Tapology votes, they're just silly. 640 total votes, 81% going Rodriguez, 70% by decision. I think if Rodriguez can stay busy enough on the feet, can push a pace, and can stay on his bike for three rounds, he can get a win over Ayman Zahabi. If I didn't make a pick on this one, I'd feel pretty good because this is honestly one of the toughest fights to pick. Again, I went back and watched so many Draco Rodriguez fights against scrubs in the regional scene that I didn't really gain a whole lot out of it other than the fact that this guy's a great prospect. And I'm really looking forward to him fighting in the UFC. If he beats Ayman Zahabi, that's a huge feather in his cap. I've seen Amon Zahabi have success like that. He was one of those guys that was the next great Canadian prospects when he made his debut. And then even after getting the win over Vieira. So for me, if Amon Zahabi can, again, do what he did in the Hamosh fight, if he can at least throw that nice kick, push a bit of a pace, rush forward, try not to get caught, and as long as you don't get hit by some spinning stuff, he can rely on his grappling. Because I think if Draco Rodriguez takes down Amon Zahabi, it's going to be weird. He hasn't faced a guy like Zahabi on the ground like that. I mean, yeah, Tony Gravely's a wrestler, so it's a different story. I'm slightly edging Rodriguez in this fight, but again, I would not be surprised if Amon Zahabi won it whatsoever.
So I do agree, and for a lot of the variables that you have brought up, the movement of Zahabi is going to be really important in this fight. And as the fight progresses, he does tend to get more stationary. We saw that in the Hamosh fight. He'll do really well, and he is good at staying active early on in the fight, but he will kind of settle in as the fight progresses, and that does worry me against a guy like Draco Rodriguez, because if Zahabi could stay on his bike thoroughly throughout the 15 minutes, it would be really hard for Draco Rodriguez to find him. But the fact that Zahabi will get a little stationary and plant his feet, I like the activity of Rodriguez, and like you had said, when the fight hits the mat, I'm not going to really predict anything, because who knows how it's going to go, but I do like Draco Rodriguez in this fight.
If this gets past a first round, then maybe I'd and this is going to kind of contradict what you said. I might slightly edge one guy over the other, so I'd like to see it pass one round, because with Zahabi, again, he can typically stay on his bike all right. In the fight that he had against Vieira tired, and he just started shooting just kind of like desperation takedowns by the third round. That's why Zahabi's takedown defense is so high. It's because of that one fight, because Vieira went 2 for 13. In his second fight against Hamosh, he kind of stayed on his bike, and again, second round was good. First round was all right. Third round, he was gaining until Hamosh did one spinning elbow. And Joe Rogan, it's been a long time since he's had some good commentary, but in that one, he goes, Hamosh is looking for the spinning back elbow. He's kind of loading up with his weight. And then he really landed it to the point where he knocked him out cold. And then, we didn't even talk about it, but the fight against Vince Murdoch, Murdoch just pressured him, switched stances, threw low kicks, really threw the kitchen sink at him, and just frustrated him overall. And you can tell Zahabi's a cerebral guy. In that interview with Al Deas, they talked about the fact that he's been reading a lot of psychology books, trying to be mind over matter, trying to really press a pace within himself to put on a good fight. So I'll be interested to see which Zahabi we get in this one. But Matt, yeah, both in agreement with Draco Rodriguez here. Might not be the most confident one, but hell, I'm really looking forward to this fight at bantamweight. It should be a great one. We got a great card coming up. Wonderboy Thompson taking on Jeff Neal in our main event. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Dana White never puts on catchweight fights, but this year Dana White puts on catchweight fights. And we get a fight at 195 pounds between Deron Wynn and Antonio Arroyo. And Matt, this fight really interesting because this is truly a clash of styles. And I get to say it, for Deron Wynn, American Kickboxing Academy product, you know exactly how good the wrestling is. He was undefeated coming into the UFC at just 5-0, picked up a big win over Eric Spicely in his debut, threw some of the most significant strikes ever landed in the middleweight division against Spicely, the grappler. And then he fought Darren Stewart to a split decision loss, which Darren Stewart won that fight, 100%.
It was a weird fight.
Stewart won that fight. And then he fought Gerald Meerschaert in a fight where, listen, Meerschaert not that long ago was supposed to take on Ed Herman at 205 pounds. He's one of the bigger guys at 185. I know his fight against Khamzat didn't go all that well, but nobody's had a good fight against Khamzat Chimaev, so I think I can say that now. And he was supposed to be in the main event of this weekend's card, so take that for what it's worth. But for Deron Wynn, he got submitted by Gerald Meerschaert in that one, and it was one of those ones where wrestling and jiu-jitsu don't really mix, especially with a guy like Deron Wynn. His jiu-jitsu is not the best jiu-jitsu in the entire world.
I agree, but I think we're kind of judging or clouding over a major part in that fight. He got hurt with a straight right and rocked, and then he got submitted. It's not like Deron Wynn is bad at jiu-jitsu by any means. It's just, for him to have success, he normally has to get in the top position. Getting submitted by Gerald Meerschaert by no means means that you are bad at jiu-jitsu. And the fact that he did get caught with a big shot before that, I'm sure didn't help his case.
And his originally scheduled opponent for this fight probably would have gotten that out of him. John Allen type. It's my guy, Antonio Braga Nieto, who... Where you at, Antonio? I wish you fought more often. It was a shame that we don't get to see him in this week. In steps Antonio Arroyo, and 2020 hasn't been very fair to the Brazilian fighter in this one, because he was originally supposed to take on Trevin Giles back in February, but he fell ill due to his weight cut, or after the weigh-ins. Then he was supposed to take on Greece's Andreas Michailidis back last month. That one fell through. Then he's supposed to take on Eric Anders. Anders out due to weight cut. which is like the day of, which was really unfortunate because we both had Eric Anders to win that fight. And now in this one, Antonio Hoyo gets Duran win. Now, Matt, the major sticking point in this fight is that Antonio Hoyo is so much bigger and longer than Duran Nguyen. I know his reach advantage isn't huge. I think it's, what, 3.5 inches? I got it right there. His height advantage is giant. It's 9 inches. So Duran Nguyen's only got one game plan. He's not going to Roy Nelson, Stefan Struve in this fight. So Duran Nguyen going to wrestle. Antonio Hoyo is going to strike. And Matt, for Antonio Hoyo, I know a lot of people talk about it, and we've talked about it in the two prediction videos we've done on Antonio Hoyo. People bring him in to emulate Thiago Santos. And if you close your eyes and put your fingers in front of them and just kind of squint a little bit, it looks like Thiago Santos. He's Brazilian. He fights from an orthodox stance.
Big.
He's jacked. And he does the one thing that Thiago Santos does somewhat often. He throws a left high kick, he comes crashing forward, and throws pretty tidy punches. And if he mixes in a little bit of an uppercut there, some knees, it really makes for a special fight. We saw it in the fight against Andre Muniz in both of their UFC debuts back in Brazil. It was a good fight. It was somewhat of a close fight. Muniz got the win, but Antonio Hoyo got himself in all kinds of bad positions on the ground in that one.
He really did. And for Hoyo, this fight is basically the lowest version of Glover Teixeira versus Thiago Santos, because you're going to see one guy's going to primarily strike with
Hoyo. Because of the height?
And also a little bit because of the height. And with Duran Nguyen, not that he fights very similar to Glover Teixeira, I doubt he's going to get dropped and then go immediately into mount, but it will be interesting to see how he deals with such a size disadvantage. And with Duran Nguyen, you know, we talked about before we started filming, he has fought at 205, not the ideal weight class for him at all. 185 isn't even the ideal weight class for him. I understand he has missed weight at 185, but that's more just like, hey, John Lineker, what are you doing? Get it together. Daniel Cormier himself, when he commentates Duran Nguyen's fight, says that he could fight at 170. And that's what the guys over at AKA want him to do in the future. The fact that he is fighting up at 195, it seems like they're giving Hoyo a big advantage by doing so. Because for Hoyo, he's the one who has had a hard time making 185. And yes, Nguyen has missed weight at 185, but Hoyo had to get taken away from a fight because medically it was so hard to cut that weight. And for Hoyo, I do think he will have success in this fight. I do think the size is going to give him a big advantage in the striking, because when he lands on Duran Nguyen, it is going to hurt him. The question mark really comes down to, can Hoyo go for 3 hard rounds? With Duran Nguyen, like you had mentioned, he can't only keep a high volume. He set the record for significant strikes landed in a middleweight fight in his UFC debut. You know he is going to be able to last all 3 rounds. Now, the big counter to what I just said would be the Darren Stewart fight. And that might be the weirdest MMA fight I've ever seen, because it was one guy decided, I'm only going to go for takedowns. The other guy decided, I'm just going to box. And it was just kind of judged very odd, because on the feet, Darren Stewart would beat the brakes off Duran Nguyen, but Duran Nguyen would get about 7 takedowns a round. And then it kind of came up to, okay, well, what are we going to weigh more?
There was
judging?
A lot of bad blood in that fight,
there
too.
There was, and it was weird that the fight was so awful because of it. But I'm really hoping we get a great version of this fight. And I do think the size is actually going to be a detriment for Antonio Hoyo. I like what Duran Nguyen does in his wrestling. He is very single-leg heavy, and we've seen it from Daniel Cormier, and Daniel Cormier can explain it much better than I'm going to attempt to, but for a single-leg takedown, using those against a bigger guy, you're forcing them to use their balance, and the taller you are, the harder that's going to be to do. And for Hoyo, we've seen him struggle with very wrestling-heavy attacks, and like you had mentioned, he does make some, I hate to say rookie mistakes on the ground, but the Thiago Santos comparison goes past the striking. Off his back, Hoyo isn't very good. And if Duran Nguyen can get that first takedown, can get that second takedown, he's just going to keep on building upon that success. So it really comes down to, I think we're going to tell the story of this fight in the first minute. If Hoyo can defend a takedown, start landing good leg kicks, and start piecing up Nguyen on the feet, we're going to know exactly how the rest of the fight's going to play out. Whereas if Duran Nguyen can get into the clinch, start using his dirty boxing, and really attack heavy with his wrestling game, I think Duran Nguyen should be able to run away with this fight. So I think this is one of those classic, the traffic's only going to be going one way. I just don't really know which way it will be.
And this is one of those weird things that I never thought that I'd bring up in an Antonio Hoyo fight, but I am. And listen, whoever thought they'd be talking about an Antonio Hoyo fight in December 2012, but we are. If you go back and watch his fight against Steven Regman on Contender Series, he got taken down 3 times. He ended up submitting Regman. That's cool. Steven Regman. Cool. Nobody's talking about Steven Regman in December 2020, unless you're Steven Regman and his family getting ready for the holidays. In the Andre Muniz fight, this is where Antonio Hoyo made...
What did Steven Regman do to you?
He didn't do anything to me. Kudos to Steven Regman. You're a real G, I guess. But overall, if you go back and watch that fight against Andre Muniz, Antonio Hoyo made a fatal mistake really early on. I know it ended up as a decision. He pieces up Muniz. They get into a clinch, and then Antonio Hoyo goes, well, yeah, I'm a Greco-Roman wrestler. He does a head and arm throw and launches Muniz to the canvas, which was such a mistake because Muniz was a grappling specialist in that fight. And Muniz had success on the feet because it was one of those ones where, well, I don't want to play the grappling, so I guess we'll play the striking game. And I got to worry about blocking the takedown attempts, so Muniz tapped him up. It wasn't so. Muniz's striking wasn't too bad. Now, Muniz's a tall guy at 85. Deron Wynn's short guy. So you'd think, well, again, like you said, it's going to be a tale of two fights. Ohio's kicks. And listen, yes, I read all the comments under the fight with Eric Anders, and everybody that picked Ohio and said we were nuts for picking Anders said he's got to establish his kicks. Newsflash, he doesn't throw them in bunches. It's usually one to set up the hand. So his kicks are great, but he's got to really land a lot of them, especially against a guy like Deron Wynn. That's how you can definitely put him out. Little guy, you kick him a lot. For Deron Wynn, though, again, Antonio Hoyo has decent wrestling up top, but down below it's not as great. So if Deron Wynn could just shoot, especially with those singles, maybe not a power double because he could get stuck in something, but if he can work the singles, if he can really pressure and tire on Ahoyo. And listen, I watched different interviews with these two guys. I watched a lot of different stuff, so I won't say who or why this is at a catchweight of 195, but one of these guys wanted this to be a catchweight at 195, so you got to keep that in mind. Matt, if we have a look at the odds for this one, a little bit of a surprise. They're actually very close with Antonio Hoyo, the favorite, open to minus 175. The line popped up. Now it's going back down. He's a minus 154. For Deron Wynn, he is the underdog, open to plus 150. He's now at a plus 128. And if we have a look at the Tapology vote, 642, 71% have a Hoyo to win, 51% have him to win by submission. Matt, Antonio Hoyo has won fights by submission in the past. He's won 3 of his 9 total. What and who are you going with in this fight?
That's so weird that many people thought Antonio Hoyo was going to submit Deron Wynn. Okay, you know that meme where it's like, hey, Mom, can we get Daniel Cormier? And it's like, Mom, we have Daniel Cormier at home. That's what Deron Wynn is. He really is just a light version of Cormier. He makes a lot more mistakes, though, and that does worry me. I could see Antonio Hoyo coming out and just knocking out Deron Wynn early. I really can. And Deron Wynn, for me, he's slowly creeping into that, like, Claudia Gadelha mix where I'm just like, I can't get a read on your fights no matter what. I do think Wynn's going to be able to get this one, though. I do like his wrestling offense, and I do just think that his style plays to beating a guy like Ahoyo. So although Ahoyo could go out there, get a quick finish, and I could look very dumb, I do think Deron Wynn's going to be able to outlast him and just be that king of the grind.
That's it. I mean, Antonio Ahoyo, he's one of those guys that, again, lands power shots on the feet. He's not afraid of taking somebody down, and his jiu-jitsu's not bad. I mean, Andrea Muniz is just very good at jiu-jitsu. That's a specialty. So it's tough to really get a whole read, and then you look at the rest of the fights that he has. Diego Enrique, Dana White's Contender Series 2018, he picks up a decision win there. Steven Regman, where you at? Before that, we're talking Adriano Miranda, 1-1, Antonio Saras, 2-4, Trevor Carlson, 11-2, but if we really go through Trevor Carlson's record, again, it is what it is. So it's tough to get a read on a guy like this. I know they bring him in to replicate Thiago Santos, and that's great, but I've heard a lot of fighters that people bring in to replicate. Like, again, if Dominic Cruz is bringing in, who was it, Jose Quinones to replicate TJ Dillashaw, those are the fighters that people talk about. Like, you got to really watch some of those comparisons. So Antonio Hoyo, definitely an opportunity to win. I could see him winning by knockout, like you said, early on. I think as the fight wears on, Deron wins, so I'd be interested to see how this works out round by round. But yeah, I'm going to go with the underdog in this one, the slight underdog in Deron Wynn to get the win. I think if he's able to get some early takedowns together, just stay heavy on top. I know he's a smaller guy, you know, stature-wise, but 195, he's thick. So Matt, I'm going with thick boy, Deron Wynn to get the win.
I agree 100%. Thick boy should have this one.
Going thick boy. Both of us going with Deron Wynn to get the win. Really looking forward to this fight. We have 15 fights total on this card. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say,
let's get into it.
Jadakiss would love this fight because the champ is here. We have Dolce champ, Dolce Lujanbula, the former EFC heavyweight and light heavyweight champ, taking on Baby K. Carl Roberson, Glory standout. Matt, Glory fighters in MMA have had a lot of success in 2020. Just ask, I don't know, Alex Pahe over with LFA. Watch out for that left hook. Just ask, you know, George's Giga Chikadze. Hey, having a lot of success at 145 pounds. Matt, Carl Roberson, unfortunately out of last weekend's scheduled fight against Dolce champion due to COVID-19, but he will be in this weekend taking on Dolce Lunjumbula. And Matt, we went back and previewed this fight before last weekend, then everything was lost in the fire, albeit I just deleted everything from my computer. So we'll start anew. But overall, I'm really excited about this fight. I mean, it is the definition of a striker's paradise, because for Dolce Lunjumbula, he's a fourth degree black belt in judo. He competed for the Congo in the 2006, 2007, and 2008 games. He also competed at ADCC. He won the trials for Africa, and that was back in 2016. He is a second degree black belt in judo, rather. And he's 35 years old, and Matt, the weird thing is, he's moving down to middleweight for this fight. All things that concern me, but you know what doesn't concern me about this fight for Dolce champion? The fact that he switched up camps, went over to the United States of America, and he is training with my favorite coach in all of MMA. I'm talking about a guy that hates right-handed sleeves. I am talking about Black Cobra Striking Systems' own Dewey Cooper. And Matt, we've seen Dewey Cooper in some pretty big corners. I know he's always out there for Kevin Lee and a lot of the guys that train out of Vegas. And whether you love him or whether you hate him, he is always there with his arm raised up, just hyping up these fighters. And we've seen a lot of tape from Dewey Cooper training with Dolce Lunjumbula. I was really, really worried about the weight cut, and I still kind of am. But Dolce looks great in the videos that I've seen. Physically, he looks good. And you always worry about a guy like that. You know, he's had a bit of a mixed bag so far in the UFC. A win over Daquan Townsend finishes him. And then the fight against Magomed Ankalaev, where it could have gone a lot of different ways. It was a lot of power punching from Dolce Lunjumbula trying to, break ground. And Magomed Ankalaev's kicks were really the difference maker in that one.
They were, and it is really weird you look at how Dolce champs UFC run's gone. Because, okay, you knock out Daquan Townsend. That's a thing that can happen. And then you lose Ankalaev, who is at the top of the division right now. So basically, I know you're better than Maxi Kleber, but you're worse than Giannis Antetokounmpo. That's the kind of range that we're talking about right now. And it is hard to just put where his ceiling is exactly, because Dolce does a lot of things that are going to get him fans in the UFC. Does he put on fun fights? Yes, he does. Does he have insane finishes? Of course, all the time. And I like what you brought up about Dewey Cooper. He is going to help him sort of refine some of that striking technique, because when you kind of think about Dolce Lunjumbula, you don't think about the judo credentials and how good of a grappler he is. Everyone knows him for the crazy knockout power and the phenomenal striking that he does have. And if he does hook up with a guy like Dewey Cooper, who can just sort of refine some of those techniques, it can make Dolce a very terrifying fighter down at middleweight. The weird thing is, though, he's making this weight cut at the age of 35, and it is always odd when a guy does decide to move down in weight as opposed to up in weight. We've seen that it can help if you're a guy like Jared Cannonier. You can go all the way from heavyweight down to middleweight and just completely look like a different human, honestly. And for Dolce, he has fought at heavyweight. He will be making this move down to middleweight. It's weird that they're making it against a guy who has missed weight at middleweight in the past. Ideally, you would think, just make this fight at 205, make Dolce move down perhaps further on in his career, or maybe not further on, just wait until the next fight. Because Carl Roberson, it's not like making 185 is an easy thing for him to do at this stage in his career either. So I just find it odd that they're deciding to do this one at middleweight more than anything.
I mean, it's Lunjumbula's 13th pro fight, and it's his first one at middleweight. He's been a pro since 2014. He has wins over some recognizable names. Alain Badeau, that we saw in the corner of Ciryl Gane this past weekend. Yannick Bahati as well, that you kind of know and maybe love from the EFC scene. He's fought over in Europe as well. And Matt, I really took a lot of notes about the fight that he had against Ankalaev, because it was the last time that we saw him out. And it was one where Ankalaev, southpaw, heavy on the lead leg was Dolce champ, which is something that I worry about. And even in the training videos, he's really heavy and he kind of presses forward, throws a wild overhand right. Carl Roberson's a classically trained striker, and he excels against guys kind of like Dolce Lunjumbula. And I feel like if Roberson's going to have a lot of success, just chop down on that lead leg. You look at Roberson's last fight and his last loss, it was earlier on this year. I'd say a rivalry, because these guys hated each other, but with Marvin Vettori, who, again, top of the division at 185, and that's the thing with Carl Roberson. You look at the fights that he's had so far in the UFC. Well, he picks up the win on Dana White's Contender Series, which was the first season, Ryan Spann. Ryan Spann's pretty good at light heavyweight. I know he kind of tires in fights, but that was in the first round, and Ryan Spann's liable to go for double legs, stick with it forever, and get elbowed. It happens. So after Roberson beats him, he then fights Darren Stewart, finishes him in the first round, submits him. Carl Roberson isn't a submission specialist. Well, then he gets submitted by Cesar Fajeh. And listen, I get it, PFL's finest. But Cesar Fajeda is a pretty good litmus test, I guess.
Oh, 100%.
So Robertson, not time for the top 15. Cesar Fajeda beats him. And that was in the featured prelim of UFC 224, which was just a weird card in general. Roberson then fights Jack Marshman in a pretty high-profile fight. Beats him by decision. That's a good one. Then he moves up to 205 and fights one of light heavyweight's best in Glover Teixeira. Loses that fight. Beats Wellington Turman. Beats Roman Kopylov. Neither one of those wins really tell you a whole lot because Kopylov was 8-0 at the time. Uber prospect out of Russia. And with Wellington Turman, good prospect from Brazil, but we continue to see him making mistakes in the UFC. So for Karl Roberson, again, glory kickboxer, classic striker. And the one last thing that I wanted to say about Dolchichamp, he can catch kicks, but it's kind of weird. And he's one of those guys that has traps like Triple H in 2003. And you don't need those for MMA.
I agree, actually. Being that heavily muscled, in MMA tends to be a detriment. And this is a question I get a lot from like my extreme casual MMA fans who are just kind of asking about the sport to be friendly. They go, why aren't MMA fighters built like bodybuilders? It's not beneficial at all. When you are that heavily muscled, I'm going to have such a Joe Roganism right now. When you're built like that, you tend to get tired fast. And I know people hate bringing it up, and guys like Tyron Woodley disagree with it, but it is the truth. If you have muscles, they need oxygen.
The mitochondria in the cells, Matt. Yes. They got to get the energy.
Exactly. Now, if we are dealing with the force, maybe Dolce goes out there, hip tosses old Karl Roberson, and that'll be the end of the fight. It's weird, though, when you look at Karl Roberson, he struggles with more physical grapplers, and if Dolce wanted to employ that game plan, he'd be more than capable of it. It's not how he fights MMA, though. It is very odd. Dolce will play Karl Roberson's game, even though I do think he has the skills to beat Roberson. If he decided to make this a more grappling-heavy fight, even though Dolce should be a more technical fighter since he has started training with Dewey Cooper, who's a phenomenal boxing trainer, I just don't think it will be enough to get him over the ledge and get him over the level to make him a threat against Karl Roberson on the feet. Because Karl Roberson, we've seen him struggle with grapplers. No one's made him even really break a sweat in the stand-up in the UFC. He has some of the better kickboxing you're ever going to see. And yes, his record is a little salty. He's got some less than great wins in there. But Karl Roberson's going to be able to outstrike 99% of the people he fights in the UFC, and I really like him in this fight.
And I mean, Matt, you never know how the COVID could affect a guy, especially like Karl Roberson. I mean, look at Eduardo Rodriguez with my Boston Red Sox, lost the whole season due to complications, and Cody Garbrandt as well, really falling out of the picture at 125 pounds. So that fight scrapped last weekend. Now we get it this weekend. Apparently, you can get over it in a week and you're not contagious anymore. I'm not an expert. I don't know. It doesn't seem smart. But in this fight, Matt, Karl Roberson opened a minus 170 favorite. He's now minus 269. And for Dolce Champion, the underdog opened plus 145. He's now at a plus 216. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, 531, so it's a limited sample size. 70% of fans going Karl Roberson. 59% of fans picking him to win by decision. Matt, are you in agreement with the odds makers and the fans in your brain?
Yeah, again, it's really hard to pick against the more technical guy out of these two. And the fact that Dolce is a primary striker when it comes to MMA, I know his background is more grappling heavy, but he fights like an MMA striker. It's going to be really hard to beat a guy like Karl Roberson, especially Dolce does crash forward a lot. And with Karl Roberson, we saw with Gabriel Benitez versus Justin James, if you do crash forward and you're facing a guy who is really technical on the feet, he can throw knees to the body, he can catch you with elbows on the way in. I just like a lot of the ways that Karl Roberson can keep Dolce off of him. For that reason, it's hard to pick against Karl Roberson.
Matt, I'm going with Karl Roberson in this one as well. Now, it is a tricky one. And with a guy like Dolce Lunjumbula, I mean, he has staying power. I don't know how that'll work out at 185 pounds. And you got to worry, a guy who's had 13 pro fights, or this is his 13th pro fight, fought at heavyweight and light heavyweight. He's 35, and it's like, well, we'll just go down to middleweight, move to the States for a little bit, train with Dewey Cooper, and hope things work out. I hope it works out. I like watching Dolce Lunjumbula. I think he's a great fighter, and if he picks up a win here, that's huge. Matt, so we're both going with Karl Roberson to pick up the win, and hey, this is a great card headlined by Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and the man himself, Jeff Neal, hands of steel. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really looking forward to our next fight at women's bantamweight. We have Banzai Pani Kanzad representing Sweden taking on the US of A's own Sajara Eubanks. Matt, do you remember a time when Sajara Eubanks was supposed to be the heir apparent to the UFC's inaugural flyweight championship? It seems like it wasn't that long ago. She was on the Errol Hawani show. She was talking mad smack. Like, things were looking up for Sejura Eubanks.
Sejura Eubanks is supposed to headline a pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden. Her and Valentina Shevchenko were the original headliner for UFC 230, and then, of course, DC ended up fighting Derek Lewis. But at one point, that does tell you where Sejura Eubanks was in the division.
And, I mean, it's crazy to think. You look at her last five fights, and, I mean, yeah, two wins, three losses. It is what it is. But, I mean, if we go back to the fifth to last fight, it was only a year and a half ago against Aspen Ladd. She loses a decision.
Fight of the night.
Albeit, yeah, fight of the night, a decently close fight. She loses to Betch Gohei in a fight that wasn't very close. And Betch is liable just about every fight for, you know, walking back to her corner while the fight's still going on or punching herself in the face and getting rocked. And in Sejura Eubanks' next fight, she beats Canada's own Cupcake Sarah Morris. She has a win over Julia Vila, which was a weird fight because it was a short notice comeuppance, so to speak. And then in her last fight, which was only 2.5 months ago, she lost to Ketlin Vieira. And Vieira was coming back. I mean, she took a tough loss against Irene Aldana in her last fight, took a long time off, and picked up a great win against Sejura Eubanks.
She did, and she beat Sejura Eubanks doing a lot of things that Eubanks does well herself. Because when you talk about Sejura Eubanks, she fights a little bit like a Daron Wynn, who we talked about previously. She's going to go for a lot of takedowns. She is a very high-volume fighter. She does something that I don't really like, but we do see it a lot in sort of women's MMA. She just is extremely aggressive, and sometimes that will win you fights. We saw that in the Aspen Ladd fight. That's really what made that fight so close to begin with, because Aspen Ladd, she's a more technical striker. She's better on the floor. But Sejura Eubanks would just rush at her and throw really high volume, and that made that fight a lot closer than it probably should have been. But that does come back to bite you. She tried to do the same thing against Betch Gohea, but against Betch, her cardio wasn't really there, so she had really high output for that first round. But you could tell that she was just kind of fighting herself almost as the fight progressed. She couldn't keep up the volume that she was trying to keep pace with. And it has been really weird for Sejura Eubanks, because even at 135, she's much physically stronger than a lot of the women who she will be fighting. But her cardio is such a big question mark, and I know we have seen improvements in it. In the Sarah Morris fight, she did look a lot better. In the Julia Avila fight, she did look really good. She just defended a lot of takedowns and kept that fight on the feet, though. And for Panic Kianzad, she'll be able to take advantage of some of the shortcomings that Sejura Eubanks brings to the table. The fact that she does have such a big reach advantage, and she will play on the outside quite a bit, it's going to be hard for Eubanks to get inside on her. If she is going to try to have a more wrestling-heavy game plan in this fight, I do think she's going to have a hard time getting past the jab and the kicks of Panny Kianzad.
And I mean, with Panny Kianzad, not to really slag you too much, but as far as reach is concerned, they have Sejura Eubanks' reach a little bit more, just 1 inch more than Panny Kianzad, but the height advantage definitely with Kianzad, the fighter out of Sweden, coming out of Gym Arte Suave, you know, Emil Mech trains there, among others, so that's kind of neat. But for Panny Kianzad, again, works well from the outside. If you want to play MMA math with this fight, you're going to be chasing your tail, because Betch Gohea beat Sejura Eubanks and lost to Panny Kianzad in a fight where, you know, she made Betch Gohea mistakes. Panny Kianzad lost to Julia Vila. Sejura Eubanks looked great against Julia Vila, so who's going to win this fight? Well, don't look at those two fights. Look at the styles of these two fighters. Now, if we look at the Tapology vote, 658 in total, 65% going Kianzad, 89% predicting her to get the win by decision. If we have a look at the odds, maybe a little bit of a surprise, but not so much. Sejura Eubanks the favorite. Open to minus 175. The line popped up. It's coming back down again. Eubanks minus 160 right now. If you look over at Panny Kianzad, open up a plus 150. She's now at a plus 131. So, Matt, again, it's a little bit of a clash of styles. Panny Kianzad, for what it's worth so far in the UFC, has had really good takedown defense at a 92% clip. Macy Chasson tried for 6, was unable to get any of them. I know she did get taken down in her last fight, and that's the lone blemish against Betch. Rowdy Betch. But, I mean, that's a former title challenger.
It is. Maybe not one of the better ones. We'll loop her in with maybe a Jessica I, for instance. Goodness, harping on a lot of these fighters, but it will be interesting. I do think Sejura Eubanks, if she can get on top of Panny Kianzad, she's going to give her a lot of trouble. The ground and pound of Sejura Eubanks is something that's quite underrated. When she gets on top of her opponent, she makes control time really worth something. She's not just going to wait on top and hold and sort of lay and pray. She will get to work, and she is quite active on the mat. We saw that a lot in the Roxanne Modafferi fight of all of them. She was really able to keep a high output throughout, get on top, And a lot, that was a classic, Joe Rogan's going to talk about something and just keep on bringing it up. He talked about cardio a lot in that fight, but that was the one fight where Sojourner Eubanks did seem to show a big improvement in her cardio. For Panic Kianzad, it will be odd. If she can keep this fight on the outside and use some of her range, she will have success. We have seen her struggle with fighters who do have quite a bit of power. Of course, Macy was able to drop her. Julia Avila was able to drop her as well. Julia Avila, I don't know why I keep on adding the A onto the end of that. So we'll be interested to see because, again, both fighters can fight in a way that gives their opponent trouble, and it's a real split down the middle kind of fight.
I mean, the value you're missing there was an I. There's still an A there.
Avila, goodness. Yeah, I'm struggling.
No worries. But, yeah, I mean, I look at this one, again, it's probably going to be a tale of two fights. Can Sojourner Eubanks take it down to the mat? Can Panic Kianzad withstand the takedown attempts? And, I mean, again, stats-wise, it's tough. It's also tough because two totally different divisions, and then Sojourner Eubanks migrating up. But she's been a lot more active as far as takedown accuracy is concerned, 46%. I do like that. Average submissions attempted per 15 minutes at 0.4 is kind of weird because the weird X factor with Sojourner Eubanks, pretty good boxing, I would say. I think that's fair. Good enough boxing. You're going to lose to Ketlin Vieira. She was ranked number two at one point at bantamweight before losing to Aldana. And yeah, she is wild, but really good at getting the fight down to the mat and then really good at opposing her size. And it's weird to say that because she's shorter than most of the women that she fights at bantamweight, but she is usually able to impose some of that size on them. The ground and pound's great, but then in your back pocket, you have a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and you're training at a Nick Cantone MMA, and say what you will about the progression of Claudia Gadelha, but there are some good fighters to train out of that area of the world, and Mark Henry has kind of accentuated some of those good things with Sojourner Eubanks. So I'm going to slightly edge with the favorite in this one, it's Sojourner Eubanks. I know, you know, in the past I've been pretty high on Panic Kianzad. She's one of those fighters that it was just a matter of time. It wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when we were going to get her in the UFC, and we finally do have her here now. But I do like Eubanks' style in this one. I think she's just going to be able to grind out a decision in this one.
It's hard to disagree with. I am going to say don't put any money on this fight. No. There's so many question marks around it. But I do like what you said. I agree with the Eubanks pick. I do think her wrestling and her ground and pound is going to be really on point this fight. I think we're going to see a lot of that from
Matt, her. Both of us going with a really active American in this one in Sojourner Eubanks. You're not going to want to miss the rest of predictions for the card. 15 fights in total. So keep it locked in with the playlist right over there. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. Matt, as we always say,
let's get into it.
Really interesting fight kicking off our main card coming up, UFC Vegas 17. We have the former lightweight champ Anthony Showtime Pettis taking on the great white Alex Morono. And Matt, for Alex Morono, it's been a weird bag here recently. I mean, you pick out some of the wins that he's had. Sung Kinnon, he beats Zach Otto, he beats Max Griffin, he loses to Chaos Williams, and then he beats Reese McKee. And to me, it was like, well, he just lost to Chaos Williams quick in the first round. Probably a little too early to come out and fight Reese McKee. No, it wasn't. Alex Morono fought a really good fight, and that was only, less than a month ago. So we're going to be talking about a quick turnaround going from Reese McKee. And listen, Matt, we're probably the highest on Reese McKee out of anybody in North America, maybe?
I'd say North America. Europe's Reese McKee's family.
Europe's high on him, but you know, you look at that win for Alex Morono, and it was a perfect game plan. I mean, you know Alex Morono is the type of guy that has Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He has a black belt in Taekwondo. If he wants to stand and trade, he just kind of bites down on the mouthpiece and really goes for it. But he does have pretty good offensive wrestling. We've seen that so far in his UFC career. You can definitely point to the win over Zach Otto as a reason why. I know his takedown accuracy less so than that of Pettis, and his takedown defense is less. But it is pretty good for 170 pounds. Now we got to flip the script, Matt. Anthony Pettis is one of those all-timers. I mean, to me, he's a Hall of Fame caliber fighter. And I know a lot of people, maybe even myself included on certain days, say that he hasn't really been the same since 2014. I'm going to rattle off the losses, though. We got Rafael dos Anjos, he loses the belt. Then he loses to Eddie Alvarez. Then he loses to Barboza. He loses to Holloway, loses to Poirier, loses to Ferguson, loses to Diaz, loses to CDF. CDF's good. Don't tell me anything bad about my guy, Carlos Diego Ferreira. I love him. He's awesome. But other than that, Diaz, Ferguson, Poirier, Holloway, Barboza, Alvarez, Dos Anjos.
Some of the best fighters ever.
Those are all-timers, and you can't discredit any of those. The win sprinkled in there, submitted Charles Oliveira. Remember what happened last weekend? Charles Oliveira, Tony Ferguson, awesome win. Can't take anything away. Beat Jim Miller. That's a gritty win. Gritty vet, Lyme disease. Michael Chiesa. He submitted Michael Chiesa, and Matt, that's a fight that at lightweight, all right,
Chiesa looks like a different guy at 170 pounds, but still, that's an awesome win for him there. Yeah. The knockout win over Wonderboy in the main event, UFC Nashville. If you caught this week in MMA from last week, our guy, Canadian country legend, Tebe, was there in attendance, 10th row. Awesome win there. And then his last fight, a win over Donald Cerrone, UFC 249. Anthony Pettis has very, very good wins. I mean, everybody remembers the Henderson fight back with WEC and the Showtime kick him out. An added wrinkle into this this fight camp that we've seen from Pettis, I don't know if you've gone on the Underground Whisper Network and seen the videos from Facebook, but the new Showtime kick, have you seen it?
I have not. I heard
it's rumored. It's a spinning cow tip is basically what it is. Lovely. He just trips you from behind.
Okay, this fight's very interesting, and we talk about the losses that Anthony Pettis has. Anthony Pettis is in this weird point in his career where there's been so much film that you can watch about Anthony Pettis, and he does have one weakness, and that's the wrestling component of his game. Look at how Carlos Diego Fajeo was able to beat him. He just stuck himself to his chest and kept on taking him down, and it was a game plan that Clay Guida, all the way back in the day, sort of had somewhat established fighting Anthony Pettis, because a lot of people forget, Anthony Pettis came into the UFC, it's not like he got an immediate title shot. He fought Clay Guida, loses a split decision, and it just... his opponents didn't figure it out that, hey, that might be the best game plan. Take him down as much as you can. I know Anthony Pettis has phenomenal jiu-jitsu, but if you yourself are a good grappler, we saw it. Dustin Poirier, not really known for his jiu-jitsu, has good jiu-jitsu, though. He was able to just go out there, take down Anthony Pettis, sit in his guard, get in the half guard, and just really elbow him a lot from the ground and pound positions. Alex Morono, oddly enough, can do and can enact that game plan on Anthony Pettis. He's a great wrestler. He has good cardio. He has good jiu-jitsu himself. I'm just questioning the stand-up of Alex Morono in this fight because he is going to have to close the range eventually to get to Anthony Pettis. And at 170 pounds, Anthony Pettis is a much more powerful striker than he was down at 155 pounds, or at least in this stage of his career. And you have to remember, Anthony Pettis fought at 155, was the champ, moves down to 145, submits Charles Oliveira, fights Max Holloway for the belt, misses weight, but still fights for the belt at 145, and then moves up to 170 and has fought at 155. So this is a guy... doesn't really mind changing his body composition depending on what weight class he's fighting at. But no matter what, he fights in the same style. We know what we're going to get from an Anthony Showtime Pettis fight. He's got great stand-up, really good boxing. The kicks come from so many different angles. You're not really used to seeing them. And the jiu-jitsu is phenomenal. The question comes down to, what fighters can you match Anthony Pettis up with to get the most out of this stage in his career? And I do like what the UFC did with Alex Morono. I always find it odd, and I talked about it a little bit on the recap show, when you have a former champion who's at this sort of later stage in their career when you know they're not going to win a belt anymore, it's just weird seeing Anthony Pettis with a number next to his name. And I kind of liken that to a Junior Dos Santos, or even kind of what Robbie Lawler's going through at this stage in his career, where you have a guy with a big name and they can still have competitive fights. It's just they can't have competitive fights against the elite of the elite anymore. So I like what the UFC's doing, matching Pettis up with Morono.
It's kind of different. You know, you had Carlos Condit taking on Court McGee not that long ago in this weight class. You look at Jose Aldo, what he's doing in the co-main event against Chito Vera. It's a little bit different because it's a little bit more higher profile. But in terms of age and damage, Anthony Pettis is right in that category with Jose Aldo. The fact that they're both 33, 34 years old. They've had so many title fights. I know for Pettis, obviously less so. We're talking about a GOAT and a Hall of Famer, no less, but still, it's just an odd point if you're an Anthony Pettis fan, especially if we look at the fan votes, about 670 of them, 83% going with Pettis, 62% having to win by decision. If we look at the odds, Pettis opened a minus 330 favorite, now to minus 230. So there was some money that came in on Morono, and now it's kind of dropping back down towards Pettis. But for Morono, Plus 270, went to a plus 164. He's now at a plus 192 as we tape this on Monday night. Matt, it is a tricky one. I mean, Alex Morono, very physically imposing. I know the fight, if you really want to pick out a good Alex Morono fight, the McKee one's great, it is. But to me, it's a Max Griffin fight where he rocked Max Griffin. I want to say it was second round going into the third. And then in the third round, when you get Max Griffin rocked, if you don't knock him out, the guy goes absolutely psycho. And he will just go full bore for the rest of that fight. So he awoke a demon in that one. But if Alex Morono can really just stay on his bike, make it a tough, gritty fight, he can definitely pick up some wins if he mixes in some of his wrestling. For Anthony Pettis, again, it is tricky. 2-3 in his last five, but we talk about the losses. They're to really big names. The Cerrone fight was definitely a good one for him. The Wonderboy fight was definitely a good one for him. And in terms of just pure striking, I mean, he's the more credentialed Taekwondo black belt. They're both Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts. They're both Taekwondo black belts. Pettis, I believe, is to the... is it third or fourth Dan? Third Dan black belt. So neat for Anthony Pettis. overall in this one, who are you giving the edge to? Because I do think it's a very competitive fight, and I think it's a little bit more competitive than the odds would suggest.
I'm going to kind of go against what you just said. I'm not only going to pick Anthony Pettis. I like Anthony Pettis inside the distance. I do think he's going to finish Alex Morono. Alex Morono's striking defense is not great, and we saw that in the Reese McKee fight. That was only a month ago, or I guess less than a month ago. He can get hit, and he can get hit clean, and as the fight progresses, his hands do tend to drop. We saw that in the McKee fight. He was having great success earlier on in the fight, but as the fight progressed, Reese McKee was still very much in that in the third round, and Morono was eating quite a few clean shots. And if Reese McKee and Chaos Williams are able to hit you clean, Anthony Pettis should be able to do the same thing, and I like Pettis by stoppage.
I mean, Reese McKee went 133 for 242 total strikes in that fight. That's absolutely insane. Didn't throw a lot of leg kicks, so you're going to have a fresh guy on the feet moving around for Alex Morono. But that's the thing. He doesn't really have a big spring in his step. He's kind of not lumbers forward, but you kind of catch my drift here. He's not the most fleet of foot.
Slow is a word that I would use.
But he does have a very complete game. So does Anthony Pettis. And at this point at 170 pounds, I'd be surprised if Anthony Pettis lost this fight. So yeah, I'm in agreement with you. We're both going with a former lightweight champ, Anthony Pettis, to turn back the clock, get the big win over Alex Morono. Matt, we have a really busy card with 15 total fights, headlined by Stephen Wonderboy Thompson taking on Jeff Neal, the Hands of Steel Jeff Neal. Great to see him back in the octagon. So join us over in the playlist. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Really interesting fight. In the women's flyweight division, we have Tyla Santos coming in, taking on the Canadian Jillian Robertson, the Savage. And Matt, if you watched our predictions in the last couple of weeks, we've talked quite a bit about Tyla Santos. We were really looking forward to her fight against Montana De La Rosa. Unfortunately, one of De La Rosa's cornermen tested positive for COVID. She was out of the fight. They were looking to rebook it, and then all of a sudden, Tyla Santos fighting Jillian Robertson. And for Tyla Santos, I think that's pretty smart of her. I mean, you get a ranked opponent, Jillian Robertson. You really get to ply your trade. And stylistically, Montana De La Rosa and Jillian Robertson, somewhat similar. Some would say very similar. For Jillian Robertson, you look at some of these losses that she has in her career. You look at the record overall, too. I mean, 9-4, all right, it can't be that good. All right, I'm going to read through the losses. Her first pro fight, Hannah Goldie, now in the UFC. Second pro loss, Cynthia Calvillo. That's going to happen. Barb Honchak on Tough, Myra Buena Silva, and Macy Barber. Now, Matt, I know Myra Buena Silva, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. She's had some time away. But when Myra Buena's on, she's on. She has flames tattooed to her forearm. So when she's on, she's on. You look at the wins that Jillian Robertson does have. The Pollyanna Botello fight, her last time out, she looked great. The win over Courtney Casey, where she submitted her, and that was just this past summer. And I actually remember, and I'm not going to say last names, but Andrew, if you're out there on Twitter, you hit me up in the DMs and you said, well, you know, Jillian Robertson lost to Amanda Lowen at Submission Underground. What's all that about? That can't be good. What's that loss on a record? Go watch Amanda Lowen grapple. She's one of the best women's grapplers out there, period. So there's no shame in that. I think, if anything, that's a feather in your cap that they match those two up. And it really speaks to Jillian Robertson's grappling acumen. And you look at the gym choice that I went with in the graphic that I have up there. I have Gamblers, Jiu-Jitsu, and Martial Arts, I believe is what I put. No longer training at American Top Team is Jillian Robertson. She's kind of at a bit of an offshoot, training with Dean Thomas and a myriad of coaches, if you will. So it's been very interesting. She's one of those fighters that definitely prefers that individuality rather than going to a big camp and not really getting to spend much time with the coaches. You're just spending more time sparring and getting ready with a lot of fighters, which, hey, different people, it works differently. I mean, That's just the way it is.
Different strokes for different folks. And with Jillian Robertson, so after she lost to Macy Barber, I did write Jillian Robertson off, but she has shown a lot of improvements. And whether that is her leaving the big American Top Team gym and getting some more personalized training with Dean Thomas, whether it is all because of that or just her maturation as a martial artist, she has looked really good as of late. In the Courtney Casey fight, listen, Courtney Casey's been there. She's done that. She's fought pretty much every high-level women's fighter in the UFC. And the fact that Jillian Robertson could go out there and not only beat her, but finish her is extremely impressive. And I know Courtney Casey's been on a bit of a poor streak as of late, but that's a very important win for a young up-and-coming fighter to have. And we talk about this a lot. There are some people who, yeah, they might not be the most respected fighters, but they're just names that are nice to see on a fighter's resume as they work their way up the rankings. Like, Bilal Muhammad, I would say, is a great example of that. When you look at Jeff Neal and where you can put his ceiling at, you can say, oh, well, he beat Bilal Muhammad, so he kind of passed that wrestling checkmark. Jillian Robertson passed the veteran checkmark of, okay, I'm fighting someone with a tremendous amount of experience, but I'm going to be so much better than them that the experience won't really play much of a factor into this fight. I like what you said about Taylor Santos, though, as well. She got really lucky on this short notice matchup. A lot of the times we see, for instance, Tony Ferguson went from fighting Khabib Nurmagomedov to Justin Gaethje, the two most polar opposite fighters you could ever have. Whereas now Santos is basically walking into a very similar matchup that she was originally promised last week. So it will be interesting to see, will her training for Montana De La Rosa pay off in this fight? Will the fact that she has been getting ready for a very volume-heavy wrestler, will that pay off in this fight? And I do think that that's a big benefit that she'll be coming into the cage with.
And I mean, you look at the fight that Taylor Santos was supposed to have against Montana De La Rosa, you can really point to a couple of different things. Taylor Santos has very good takedown defense. And I know she had the loss in her UFC debut, and it was to a fighter that's no longer in the UFC in a fighter that Matt has a really hard time pronouncing her name, in Mara Romero Barella.
I do.
But that is a tricky loss. You lose that one by split decision. Well, what do? You go out there and have a great performance against Meatball Molly McCann, where, again, takedown defense is on point. You can really string together your full arsenal of attacks. And this was a woman that coming into the UFC, she's 15-0. You look at the names on the resume, they're not very good. But you go back and watch her fight on Contender Series, and you realize, okay, you have to kind of build yourself up, and if that's what it took to get Taylor Santos here, then so be it. There's so many things that I like out of Taylor Santos' game. There's also a lot of things that I like out of Jillian Robertson's game, and I think her striking's really starting to come together. We know how good of a grappler she is. We know how good her wrestling can be as well. I know as far as percentages, her takedown accuracy at 50%, that is quite good. Taylor Santos normally shooting for takedowns as well, 77% so far in just the three fights that she's had. Again, Almeida on Contender Series, Romero Barella, and then McCann, 83% takedown defense over that three-fight sample size. As far as striking, again, the more volume-heavy striker is Taylor Santos. She tends to land a little bit more too. And again, to really talk matches and styles for styles, Jillian Robertson was matched up for a fight, well, just last weekend, and it fell through against Andrea Lee. Robertson was going to take on a primary striker in Andrea Lee. Now you go in against a striker that has the added X factor of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and Taylor Santos is a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Now, I don't know if it's a Thiago Santos Shogunahua black belt or if it's legit, but I know that Taylor Santos has been there against some decent competition, and she's been able to keep it standing. So for Jillian Robertson, you're only 25 years old. Taylor Santos is only 27, too. Can you take her down? Because I think that's pretty much the path to victory for Jillian Robertson. I don't see her standing and swinging with Santos in this one, finding a ton of success.
No, I agree. This fight is going to come down to grappling no matter what. I honestly think Taylor Santos is going to be going for takedowns as well on Robertson. It's going to come down to who can get the takedown. Because if Robertson can go out there, get a takedown early, really impose her will in that first round, and sap the strength from Santos, it's going to be an easier fight for Robertson moving forward. Whereas Taylor Santos, if she can start defending takedowns, really make Jillian Robertson uncomfortable on the feet. She is similar to like a Jack Hermanson, and where if she isn't able to get the takedown, not that she panics on the feet, but you can just tell that there's an overall comfort that she isn't quite there yet with her striking. So for Santos, I do think she'll have more success on the feet. I like Robertson in this fight, though. I do think she'll be able to get the takedown. I like her transitions on the mat, too. She's a very busy grappler where she won't just wait and lay and pray. She's always going for the back, sort of similar to a Damian Maia. Not that her grappling is anywhere near his level, but just the fact that she is always going for the back. It's a great position, and I do think Robertson's going to be able to get this one. It's a hard fight to predict,
though. Mean, I like what you said. She's always busy when she's on the ground. She doesn't just kind of accept and lay in somebody's guard. She's always looking to do something, and especially when you're trying to judge a fight, the judges like to see a little bit of movement as well as the top control. In terms of the predictions over on Topology, 607 of them, 70% have Robertson, 66% have her to win by decision. Taylor Santos open a minus 125 favorite. She's now at a minus 111 over on Best Fight Odds. For Jillian Robertson, open plus 105. She's now at a minus 111. So it's a pick'em fight, and I'm going to pick him a different way. I'm going to pick Taylor Santos here. I'm sticking to it. I had her to beat Montana De La Rosa. I feel like that was actually probably an easier fight for her than Jillian Robertson, but I really do like her advances in her striking. I like her ground game. I think this is definitely a winnable fight for Taylor Santos. She has a 1-inch height advantage. She is 5 inches in reach, depending on where you're at or which site you go to. But yeah, I expect Taylor Santos to be able to get the win here. Again, if Robertson gets on top early, maybe as the fight goes on, I go with Robertson. This is one that I leave off my card.
Oh, yeah.
I pick them, it's pretty juicy, but I'd leave it off. But I like Santos here. You like Robertson. We're disagreeing. But overall, really like this fight. And it really holds some important status in this women's flyweight division. A couple wins, string them together, you're right up there at the top. So really looking forward to it. Got a great playlist of fights. 15 of them in total coming up on this card. So you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Next fight at heavyweight, we have a couple of big heavyweights. Marcin Tybura coming in, taking on Greg Hardy. And I say big heavyweights because Marcin Tybura last weighed in at 263 pounds in his fight against Big Ben Rothwell. And for Greg Hardy, coming in at 264.5, it was a great win not that long ago on the Halloween card where he took on Maurice Green, picked up a big knockout win there. And for Greg Hardy, Matt, I know the record says 7-2 with one no contest, but the no contest was Puffer Gate against Ben Sassoli, who's in jail now. Well, he's in prison. And in his loss, you look at the one against Alan Crowder, disqualification due to an illegal knee, and then the other loss where he was fighting Alexander Volkov in a fight that was halfway competitive. I mean, I know he hurt his hand in that one, but still, he can stick behind the jab. He can kind of walk around. We saw him do that in the fight against Jorgen De Castro. It didn't really look like he wanted to get in range and taste some of that power from De Castro, who had success in the first round until he just stopped doing anything in the second, third.
Not what you love to see.
It's been a weird ride for Greg Hardy since he debuted in the UFC on the same card that TJ Dillashaw popped for EPO against Henry Cejudo. But overall, a winning record for Hardy, and this is definitely his second biggest test so far in the UFC, taking on the former M1 global champion, Marcin Tybura, who, I gotta say, low-key, I love watching Marcin Tybura fight. It's weird, he's one of my guys, but this is gonna be his fourth fight in 2020, and so far he's won all three. He's passed the test with flying colors. He beat Sergey Spivak at the start of the year. He beat Max Grecian, who was stepping in on short notice to replace an absolute lightning bolt in Alexander Romanov, and then Ben Rothwell in his last fight. And Matt, while Big Ben hasn't been that great in the return to the UFC, I mean, he picked up a win over Vince St. Preux in a very forgettable fight, Marcin Tybura has looked good in 2020.
Okay, I just think we have to address something that Craig just said. Marcin Tybura is not one of his guys. I've heard Craig rag on Marcin Tybura fights quite a few times. Neither one of us were excited for that Ben Rothwell fight. Quit lying to people.
Stylistically, this fight on paper is one of the more boring fights you can make at heavyweight, but you have to see these guys, and it has to happen.
He did look great, though, and it was a great fight, and it was a fight that we kind of predicted wrong, not based on who was going to win, but just how entertaining the fight was going to be. It ended up turning into a really fun fight at heavyweight. And this is what it really comes down to for Greg Hardy. We've only seen him one time against a high-level fighter, and that was Alexander Volkov. And I get we didn't really see the best version of Volkov in that fight. It was one of those kind of low-risk or high-risk, low-rewards. If you're Volkov, okay, if you get knocked out by Greg Hardy, you're a scrub. And if you beat him, no one really cares. You just beat Greg Hardy. So Tybura is going to be his first introduction into fighting one of those good, kind of grimier grappling style fighters in the heavyweight division. Marcin Tybura, it's very hard to look good against him because he does. He just has this constant pressure. He's a decent striker. He has good dirty boxing, and his grappling is quite overwhelming for most guys.
He's the type of guy that presses you up against the cage, closes his eyes and puts his face right in your chest, and then just pushes forward and tries to go for head position. He's like a dog on the couch looking for your affection. That's the way Marcin Tybura fights for the most part. And it's really interesting because, again, for Greg Hardy, one of the bigger heavyweights that you're going to find, Marcin Tybura, maybe not so. Again, I accentuated the fact that he's weighed in heavy in the past, but he's normally in that average, you know, 250 to 260 range. And coming in here on a big three-fight win streak. So, Matt, we have a look at this one. Tybura with the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his back pocket. And I know a lot of people, myself included, would say, well, Marcin Tybura, he's won three in a row. How'd he fare before that? Well, he's 1-4 on a bad streak, but you look at the losses. Fabrizio Werdum in a fight where, well, you're taking on a former champ back in 2017. Bad things are going to happen. Then he fights Derek Lewis. He gets finished in that fight. But just like we said in the Ayman Zahabi fight against Ricardo Ramos earlier on tonight, UFC 217, Zahabi was doing great until two spinning back elbows landed and knocked him out. Marcin Tybura was doing great until Derek Lewis just kept popping up and then knocked him out. Then for Tybura, he fights Stefan Struve. Well, you're going to beat Stefan Struve. I mean, Tai Tuivasa knocked him out in the fight and after the fight there not that long ago this year. He loses to Shamil Durkhimov. That's a tricky one. I mean, as Corey Anderson would say, there's levels to this game. And listen, Abdurakhimov beats Tybura. Blades beats Abdurakhimov at that game. So never match up Marcin Tybura with Curtis Blaydes, please. And then for Tabora, he loses to Augusto Sakai in a fight where he's knocked out in the first minute. He gets kicked, he gets punched, and he's asleep. So Matt, we look at Tabora on the run. We look at Greg Hardy, two nice wins in a row. But Jorgen De Castro, who was compromised for about two-thirds of that fight. And Maurice Greene, Maurice Greene changed his life totally to devote it to mixed martial arts. Moved into the Jackson Wink, living in the dorms, getting ready for it. But Greg Hardy was better than him. And I mean, that was just...
It's not much of a hot take, Craig.
That was just what was going to happen. The Tapology votes and, the odds in this one really surprised me. Because out of 735 total votes, 57% have Tabora, 73% have him to win by decision. For the 43% of fans that pick Greg Hardy, 77% have him to win by knockout. And if we look at the odds, Greg Hardy's the favorite. Open a plus 115 underdog. He's now a minus 122 favorite. For Marcin Tybura, open a minus 135. He's now at a plus 102. So, Matt, I don't know if it's one of those circumstances where we see this. I know we see it. You know, sometimes Conor McGregor pops up in the pound-for-pound rankings and then goes away. But sometimes... You know, certain names have that allure of, well, geez, I know that guy, so I'm going to put my money on him. I don't know if this is one of those circumstances. I really don't, because we have a difference between the way the odds are going and the way the Tapology votes are going. I love it when that happens, by the way. What's your take on this fight? Because it feels like A, clash of styles, but B, there's a definite path to victory for both guys here.
Oh, of course. Now, here's the problem. The path to victory for Greg Hardy is land a right hand. And it's really hard when that's your only avenue for victory. Because I don't see Greg Hardy out-grappling Marcin Tybura. That's never going to happen. He's not going to outlast him and out-jab him and work his way to a three-round decision against Tybura. So it comes down to, can Greg Hardy eventually find the shot that's going to knock out a guy like Tybura? And again, it's not an impossible task. People have been able to do it. Augusto Sakai, of course, able to knock him out quite fast. But if Marcin Tybura can really just withstand that first 3-4 minute rush, it's not like Greg Hardy has the cardio of Derek Lewis where he can keep his power so late into a fight. If Tybura is able to take down Greg Hardy even one time, I have to say this, he's going to destroy him on the ground. I don't see these two being very competitive if it does come down to grappling. It's really hard for me to pick against Tybura, not only to do with I just like his overall MMA game, the amount of experience that he's had against high-level competition. You might not always beat those top guys, but at least getting in there does teach you quite a bit. I like Tybura in this one.
I mean, just like that old Counting Crows song, Marcin Tybura is really just hanging around this town on a corner. I don't know what the Polish version of that song is. Maybe Axon sings it. But Matt, if I'm looking at this one, I agree with you. I mean, Marcin Tybura, that slow, grinding, grimy style, the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his back pocket. He's definitely taken on names like this before. He's lost to some good grapplers. He's lost to some good strikers. And I could see him just wearing on Greg Hardy. Now, if Hardy can withstand the first takedown, and if we get into the second round where Hardy had a little bit of success on the feet, he could mix things up. I'd be interested to see what the odds are at after the first round. But overall, in a 3-round fight, I have Marcin Tybura to win this one. I'm really looking forward to it. It really adds a bit of intrigue into the lower tier of this heavyweight division from 10 down. I mean, again, just like women's flyweight, a couple of wins, you're right up there near the top. I mean, Ciryl Gane picking up a big win over Junior Dos Santos really opened a lot of eyes as to what can be done in this heavyweight division. But that said, Matt, we both have Poland's Marcin Tybura to get the win. Matt, we have a really busy card this weekend, 15 fights in total, so keep it locked in with the playlist over there, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Bantamweight in 2020 is straight fire. We've got another great fight coming up. We have the Magic Man himself, Marlon Moraes, taking on New England's own Rob Font. And Matt, for the New England Cartel under Tyson Cherchier, it's been a wild year. I mean, Calvin Kattar's booked to fight Max Holloway. Rob Font has a fight against Marlon Moraes. Things are really looking up for the guys kind of training in and around Lozon's MMA. And for Rob Font, it's been a minute. It really has. And I mean, if you look at his run in the UFC since he joined back in 2014, a winning record so far, some big highlight reel wins over Matt Schnell, my guy D. Silva, Douglas Silva de Andrade, a win over Thomas Almeida by finish, and then his last two fights over Sergio Pettis and Ricky Simone. Matt, Sergio Pettis is that hot new thing at 135 pounds over in Bellator. And I might embellish that because I'm a Bellator guy, but no, go watch Sergio Pettis in Bellator. It's actually a lot of fun. And the win over Ricky Simone was one of those ones where you're taking out a really tough out. I know he wasn't against Uriah Faber, but that's definitely a feather to have in your cap. I think it's maybe less of a win than a win over Sergio Pettis. But Pettis was coming up from 25 to take that fight. But I digress. Rob Font, 2-fight win streak. It's been over a year since we saw him last. I'm pretty sure I saw him. I'm going to have to go back through my phone at the last NEF event I was at back in February, where Manny Bermudez took on Bruce Boynton. But in this fight, man, if you're Rob Font, it's a pretty good matchup for you, eh? Like, it's pretty good that you got a name like this, Marlon Moraes, to have that long of a layoff. And then here you go, Marlon Moraes.
Oh, 100%. And with Rob Font, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get an exciting fight when he is involved. Some of the better pure boxing you will see in all of MMA. I know it's kind of a staple of the gym when you talk about guys like him and Calvin Kattar. Phenomenal boxing, and not just phenomenal boxing, phenomenal MMA boxing. I do think that's something that doesn't get talked about enough. You can be really good at boxing, and then you come into MMA. You have to defend takedowns and kicks and leg kicks and all that. Rob Font has a really good game to incorporate over into MMA. He does check kicks quite well for a wrestler or for a boxer. It is a little odd. I do agree with you. This is a good matchup name-wise. This is a very poor matchup style-wise for Rob Font. And again, Rob Font, he has fun fights. He's taken quite a while off, which is a little concerning. And when you talk about his last two wins, beating Sergio Pettis in the way that he did was really impressive. He was able to really just stick behind the jab for the majority of that fight. And it was a really disciplined fight out of Rob Font. He never started throwing wild, thinking that he could get Sergio Pettis out of there at any point. He was really disciplined. It is odd, though, when you start looking at Rob Font and some of the guys have a power advantage over him. We go back to the Pedro Munhoz fight. Rob Font was hyped up a lot before that Pedro Munhoz fight. And of course, Pedro Munhoz is one of the top guys at 135. So losing to him, there's no shame in that. But Pedro rocks him on the feet and then is able to submit him. And it's been something that is a little concerning about Rob Font. Not that he gets finished all that often, but when you do hit him clean, he does get dropped. John Lineker was able to knock him down. Pedro Munhoz hurt him. Rafael Assunção hurt him. Those are three of the more heavy-handed guys until you get to Assunção. Assunção is not a guy who's known for his power punching by any means. He's a very technical striker and anyone could get caught. But it does worry me a little bit about Rob Font coming into this fight. And again, I'm going to say the exact same thing about Marlon. Marlon's coming into this on less than 2 months off of his last fight against Corey Sandhagen, where he didn't only just get beat, he got beat bad. And Corey Sandhagen was just giving him a lot to think about throughout that fight. He was throwing high kicks, body kicks, low kicks, really mixing in his boxing well and his footwork. The good news from Marlon is he's fighting a much more stationary target in this fight. Corey Sandhagen, again, I made the reference of Ayman Zahabi fights like he's playing Dance Dance Revolution. Corey Sandhagen's beaten that game already. He's moved on to whatever's next. He's like one of those guys you see at your local movie theater, and he's practicing for hours every single day when you're walking around the mall. That's how Corey Sandhagen fights. Rob Font is a little bit more stationary. He does sort of throw big looping shots sometimes when he knows he gets a guy hurt. And I do think it really comes down to who's the more durable guy at this stage in their career. Because I would argue Marlon traditionally has been. He can normally eat big shots. But you look at the Henry Cejudo fight. He's beating the brakes off Henry Cejudo. The fight's not even competitive. And then Henry just keeps on working his way back into the fight. He never goes away. And he is able to overwhelm Marlon throughout that fight. And then, of course, in the third round, just beats him really, really badly. And with the Corey Sandhagen fight, he's given Marlon a lot to think about, and he was able to check a lot of Marlon's kicks, which I do think was a big factor in that fight. I don't know if Rob Font can fight in that manner, though. I think this is your fight of the night. I think it's the most exciting fight on the card by far. I'm really curious to get your thoughts, because really, I'm having a hard time predicting this one.
I mean, to me, I look at it, and I want to talk about the Tapology picks, because I know, Matt, when we brought this up, it was a huge shock to both of us. 763 total votes, 86% Moraes, and 48% of fans picking him to win by knockout. For Font, the 14% that picked him, 53% by decision, 35% by knockout. And if we look at the odds, Marlon Moraes, the slight favorite, open to minus 175. He's now at a minus 150. For Rob Font, open to plus 150, now at a plus 125. So the money is coming in on Rob Font. And Matt, originally I thought, you know, Rob Font with the layoff, he's on a 2-fight win streak. The Sergio Pettis win, he looked amazing. But Pettis was coming up from 125, like on short notice. It was a weird fight. I remember the promo packs. Rob Font run around his neighborhood, and it was cold. Rob Font runs. He's in the Northeast. We're more Northeast than that. It's cold. It's getting cold now. It's starting to snow. And then you look at the last fight that he had against Ricky Simon. That's a good win, but it was a year ago. For Marlon Moraes, you look at the losses. Okay, let's look at the wins. Jimmy Rivera, where he silenced Utica, New York. Rafael Assunção, where he submitted him, which is the comeback fight. That was a revenge fight because he had lost to Assunção earlier on. Again, former common opponent between these two
and
guys.
And he didn't just submit him. He dropped him twice and then submitted him. It was a very dominant performance.
Loses to Cejudo, where he kind of gave up, and Mark Henry was telling him to win it for his family and
yeah,
such.
Yeah, that's weird.
You don't like to see that. But again, I hate this narrative in MMA. I hate this narrative in combat sports. If I've seen a guy quit, well, then he's going to quit. It's just, it's a Charles Oliveira thing. Did you watch Charles Oliveira in his win streak? Did you watch him fight Tony Ferguson? I don't like that narrative that people build up in sports. I think it's silly. Marlon gave up in that fight. Then he comes back and fights Jose Aldo. And when watching that fight, I had scored it for Marlon. I know a lot of people scored it for Jose. You scored it for Jose. Well, that's fine.
It was close, though. It was a coin flip.
I'll keep you around. I thought the Marlon won it, but still. Did it warrant a title shot? Maybe not. But I don't think it warranted one for Jose Aldo either. And then in Marlon's last fight against Sandhagen, it was like, well, Sandhagen's a grappler. He's a wonky striker.
I don't think I'd call Corey Sandhagen a grappler.
Holy Lord. I mean, look at Corey Sandhagen. Wow. So it was a huge knockout win for Sandhagen. I think bigger and better things are to come after Aljamain, knock wood, fights Piotr Jan. But for Marlon, it leaves him in a weird spot. Do you give him a top five guy, or do you just kind of reach and give him a guy like Rob Font? Rob Font, obviously, like I said to start the video, this is a perfect fight for him to take on a guy like Marlon. I feel like complete game, the edge goes to Marlon Moraes. I mean, he throws a lot of kicks. He throws them high, he throws them low. He mixes them in very well. His wrestling's good. He does kind of fade in some fights, but I don't really worry about him in this one against a guy like Rob Font. However, Fawn is a guy that stays on his bike, so you might have to worry about that. And this is a layoff where he's 33. So you're still kind of in the physical prime. I just don't love that layoff. It's kind of a weird one. And I know if you go and you look it up on Tapology, you know, he had fights that fell through before the one against Ricky Simone, but there hasn't really been a whole lot of rumbling. So where has he been?
I wish I knew. So Marlon does a lot of things that I like in this fight. And the thing that you have to do to beat a guy like Marlon Moraes, it was the only really commonality between the Cejudo fight and the Sandhagen fight. If you can eliminate Marlon's kicks, it really diminishes his game plan. He does have really good hands. He's an extremely heavy-handed fighter, but he doesn't have the technique in his pure boxing that he does in his kickboxing. And it really is important for Marlon to incorporate the kicks into his stand-up, because when he is throwing his combinations, just look at the first half of the Henry Cejudo fight, because they are a tale of two completely different fights. The first half of it is Marlon Moraes basically just teeing off on a heavy bag, and he's throwing heavy low kicks, body kicks, head kicks, really mixing it up well. But when Henry Cejudo closed the distance and was able to just eliminate basically the bottom half of Marlon, he had great success. And that's what Corey Sandhagen did, but he did it in a very different way. Corey Sandhagen, the much bigger, rangier fighter, he was able to use his own kicks to keep Marlon at such a far range that Marlon could never really get on the inside of him. Rob Font doesn't really have either one of those tools, and that concerns me in this fight. He's not a rangy enough guy that he can use his own kicks, because really, Rob Font's not going to throw a ton of kicks at you. He's a primary boxer when it comes to his stand-up, and he's not going to go out there and really put on a dominant wrestling performance like a Henry Cejudo is able to do. So the question comes down to, can Rob Font outbox a kickboxer in Marlon Moraes? And I just don't see it happening.
Or does Marlon Moraes come into this fight incredibly tentative, stay on his back foot and try and hit some of those kicks in there, and Rob Font crashes distance? I think that if Rob Font's going to get the win, he's A, got to hope for that, but B, just utilize that forward pressure, really press Marlon. And I know if Marlon loses, it's probably going to be Marlon crashing in more than anything. But for Rob Font, if he's able to kind of close that distance, really get in tight, really work his just top-heavy boxing control game, that would be a win for Rob Font. For Marlon, though, Swiss Army knife, a lot of different paths to victory. And again, in MMA, usually the kickboxer beats the boxer.
100%. Again, the leg kicks against a boxer are one of the most important things going, because if you can eliminate that front leg of Rob Font, he can't put any pressure on it to then throw his power shots of his own. And even if Marlon is tentative in this fight, being tentative is going to help you land those kicks from the outside. I really don't see... Again, I know the odds are close. Rob Font has more than a puncher's chance. He is a phenomenal boxer, and we don't really know where Marlon is at this stage in his career. It's just really hard for me to pick against the more complete guy in Marlon in this fight.
Matt, really looking forward to this fight. We're both going with Marlon Moraes to get the win, and I'm excited to see what people are going to have down in the comments section below. Let us know who you think is going to win, because, and I know I say this for certain fights and people scoff at it, but Font, at 14% of fans picking him and just a slight underdog, he is less than a hipster's pick. I think he has a very good opportunity in this fight, so I'll be eager to see what happens in this one. We have it as one of our possible fight of the night contenders. So check out that playlist over there. 15 total fights on this card. You're not going to want to miss any of it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt. As we always say, let's get into it. We have an absolute knock-em-out, drag-em-out type of fight on our main card as Michelle Pahea Demolidor is taking on Chaos Williams, the Ox Fighter. And Matt, you said this one off air, but you asked me, is this the most heavyweight, welterweight fight you've ever seen? Yeah, I think so, because one of these guys is going to get finished, and it's pretty hard to tell which one of the two it's going to be, because for Chaos Williams, I gotta say, we doubted him coming in on short notice in his UFC debut against Alex Morono. And he knocked him out in 27 seconds. And it was one of those knockouts where he just planted his feet, threw his hands, and absolutely starched poor Morono. But the thing that I really liked in that fight is how he crashed distance after he had him hurt and just kept going for him. Then he fights Abdulrazak Alhassan. And I picked Abdulrazak Alhassan to beat him. What does Chaos Williams do? The same damn thing in 30 seconds. So it took him 3 extra seconds to knock out Abdulrazak Alhassan. So 2 fights into his UFC career, Chaos Williams has stepped into the octagon for just a little bit over, because, I mean, you got to listen to Bruce Buffer or Joe Martinez say your name and whatnot, but 57 seconds in 2 fights. Chaos Williams is absolutely on fire. Murcielago MMA up there in Michigan should be proud of their guy. And I mean, the reason why I kind of doubted Chaos Williams coming into the UFC was I watched his fights and I just couldn't get a read on the guy. I mean, he hadn't really fought a great level of competition. His wins before the UFC, Jeremy Holloway, 10-3, but his record was salty. Bo Yan, who was 8-10. Ladarius Jackson, 6-5. Tony Harvey, 17-19. And the list goes on. But I mean, he's winning decisions. He's finishing guys in the first round. There's all that. Michelle Pahea. I don't know, what would you call this guy? If you could call him, give him a
whirling
label.
Dervish.
Yeah, he's a whirling dervish. He's the wildest guy in the entire world. He has 2 fights that are no contest. He fought with Road FC, everybody saw his moonsault, but if you're a big Dusko Todorovic fan in the UFC at middleweight, you probably went back and watched Serbian Battle Challenge, or Championship 19, where Todorovic just unloads against the cage and knocks out poor Michelle Pahea up a weight class. Michelle Pahea ends up winning 2 fights after that, the weird Road FC fights, and then he fights Danny Roberts, Hot Chocolate, and, you know, he's dancing, he's crying, he's throwing Superman punches and jump knees and crazy stuff because he's a wild man, and he wins that fight by flying knee and then a punch. Then he fights Tristan Connolly in a fight that he's favored to win. Connolly, you know, with EA Sports, out of Vancouver area, lower mainland BC, Pahea's a minus 450 favorite, and he loses that fight. So everybody, there's just a little bit of tinge against old Michelle Pahea. Can't pick him anymore. He fights Diego Sanchez. He's a slight favorite. He loses because, I don't know, Jason Herzog, maybe the good vibes from Joshua Fabia led Diego Sanchez to not want to continue anymore. Pahea loses that fight. And then he comes out against Salim Imadiev. And Matt, I'll never forget, because I normally listen to the fights with the TV on. And Daniel Cormier was on commentary. And when Daniel Cormier plants his flag into the moon, well, that flag stays there. And Daniel Cormier's narrative, the entire fight, was Michelle Pahea expends too much energy. He's going to gas in this fight. It's going to be a problem. Salim Imadiev has a good shot at winning this one. What did Michelle Pahea do in that fight?
He looked really good, and he had a good gas tank. Now, I think you're being a little hard on DC, because up until that fight, that was the narrative around his career. He does get tired as fights go on. You can't do backflips before a fight and expect to not get tired during said fight.
Can you salsa dance while you walk?
I mean, I can try, but I can barely even do that half. And then he's going out there and fighting people half naked in front of millions. So the fact that he can accomplish both in one night is quite substantial. This fight is hard to get a read on. And I always bring it back to something Shannon Briggs had said on the Joe Rogan podcast one time. And I just remember the clip. He had a K-1 fight once, and he said, okay, I knew fighting K-1 that, yes, I'm going to have to be dealing with kicks, and it's not something I had ever dealt with before. All I have to do is get in range, because if I get in range, it forces it into a boxing fight, and no one in kickboxing is as good at pure boxing as Shannon Briggs. Pretty straightforward. He had that 1K1 fight, forgive me, I forget who it was against, but he knocked him out in 30 seconds. He marches forward, he eats a few light kicks, he says how hard they hurt, and then he goes out there, throws one combination, drops the guy. I think that that can be brought into this fight quite well, because you look at what Michelle Pahea does. He does do a lot of the crazier kicks and techniques. He will leave himself open to get hit. And with a guy like Chaos Williams, I know we've both been somewhat dismissal of him up until recently. He really only needs one shot. We can say that a lot in the UFC, but Chaos Williams, when he lands, things stop moving. And Abdulrazak Alhassan, who at one point, really high-level striker, at one point was kind of the hotness at 170, he got flatlined, and it was one of the scarier knockouts you're ever going to see. The fact that Chaos Williams has that much power in his hands is really worrying for Michelle Pahea, because Paheya is hittable. He does leave himself open. Those crazy techniques do leave a window to be countered. And for Chaos Williams, you only need that one shot. And the reason I'd say this is very much a heavyweight, welterweight fight, both guys are either going to get the finish in the first round or get real tired and kind of sloppy throughout the next two rounds. I know Paheya has worked on his cardio. We did see that in the Amadiev fight. But I do think this is going to be one of those, okay, it's either a spectacular finish in 4 minutes or we're going to see some labored breathing throughout the rest of this one.
So let's have a look at the Tapology votes because they've been interesting tonight. Out of 730 votes on Tapology, 74% of voters going with Chaos Williams, 86% of them saying he's going to win by knockout. If we have a look at the odds, again, a little bit of a difference here because Chaos Williams, the underdog, opened at plus 150. It dropped. He became almost a favorite around a pick him. He's now a plus 104. So the odds are close now. If we have a look at Brazil's Paheya, open at minus 175, is now at a minus 129. Again, Matt, this is a difficult one because Chaos Williams is an absolute force right now. And Michel Paheya looked like he really shored up a lot of those holes that he had. And listen, Zalim Amadiev looked bad in the UFC. Really, really bad. He was one of the worst fighters I've seen come in. He was like Hadis Ibrahimov. That's another guy that just came in with a head of steam and then sucked. Or Roman Bogatov. Just terrible.
All right, Craig.
But Matt, in this one, it's really tricky because Michel Paheya has so many different belts and so many different disciplines. He's a lot of fun to watch. He's an insane man. Chaos Williams just has that one-punch knockout power. And it's not often that you see a fighter like this come into the UFC and just time after time, only twice, but 57 seconds between two fights. That's absolutely insane. Michel Paheya, I would say, more well-rounded. If Michel Paheya keeps the wildness away for a little bit and fights a cerebral fight, he's got an opportunity in this one. But if Chaos Williams embraces the wildness and goes in just absolutely crashing forward quick, he can definitely get a win here. Listen, Jamie Pickett, Amin Zahabi, who else have we talked about on this card? There's a lot of different guys, and I never say this. If you crash forward, you can win this fight. There's a lot of people on this card that could win by doing that. Listen, anybody could. It's a fist fight. But still, Chaos Williams definitely has a really good shot in this one. I have a hard time trying to pick it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So my official prediction, I'm going to go with Chaos Williams. I like the boxing heavy stance that he has. I like the power that he shows. And again, he's fighting one of the more hittable guys at 170. If Diego Sanchez can connect on you, I think Chaos Williams can probably connect on you. The difference is Diego Sanchez probably won't do that much, whereas Chaos Williams can put you to sleep. I could see Michel Paheya throwing a flying knee, Johnny Walker style, knocking out Chaos Williams, and haha, Craig and Matt look dumb on the internet. But I think Chaos Williams is the much safer pick in this one.
Chaos Williams went 10-17 out of his total strikes against Alex Morono. And in his fight against Abdulrazak Alhassan, he went 5-10. If you want the strike differential, because it's made up, his strikes landed per minute 15.79 to 3.16. 57 seconds in the octagon in two fights.
He's all right.
It's a tricky one. You know, I'll go hipster pick and I'll disagree with you. Michel Paheya definitely has a method of victory. I think if he starts to incorporate his kicks and he does weird capoeira stuff and he just throws off the timing of Chaos Williams, if he starts throwing kicks, if he starts moving around a lot, a moving target's a lot harder to hit than a stationary target. Morono, when Williams hit him, was square in front of him. When he hit Abdulrazak Alhassan, he hit him and then he crashed forward. Michel Paheya usually cuts angles. Now, that's easy to say, but it was only, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 fights ago when he fought Dusko Todorovic and got backed up against the cage and absolutely knocked out and flatlined. So I'm going to side with Michel Paheya ever so slightly. I would not put this on any cards. If you want to come back in the comments section and rag on either one of us, go right ahead. But this is a tricky one to try and predict. If there was ever a fight name picks no pick, this would be it. But I'm going Michel Paheya here.
I got Chaos Williams. Again, it could go either way. Someone's getting KO'd. That's pretty much all we can predict.
Exactly. Well, really looking forward to it, Matt. Not our most confident. You're going Williams. I'm going Paheya. But again, ask me tomorrow. I might go Chaos Williams. I got to be fully transparent and honest. I mean, let's see these guys on the weigh-ins. Let's see these guys face off and maybe get a better idea by the end of the week. But comment below because there's not a lot of people picking Michel Paheya over on Tapology, but he is still a favorite. So let us know who you're going with in this fight and the rest of the fights as well. And keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We've got a busy weekend coming up. And as we always say with Fight Night Picks, Matt, let's get into it. Support for Fight Night Picks is now brought to you by Manscaped. Who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming? Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. And Matt, I couldn't be more excited about this. Honestly, you probably saw it earlier with our fight in the night picks to start off the card, but I'm really excited to have Manscaped on board. And I mean, they make some great products. And listen, we've all been there. I have bought the generic trimmer that you buy from the big box store, brought it home, and I had a nose hair trimmer. And to be totally honest, I have a nose hair problem. I'll admit it here on the internet in front of thousands of people. I have nose hair issues. And I had one of those ones with the blades on the side. And you get it in there, it hurts. It's not fun to use. You're using that trimmer. It doesn't work very good in the shower. You can't see what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, you're trying to get in real high and tight. And you nick your nuts, and then it's a problem, and it looks really bad in the shower for the next person that has to hop in the shower. If you don't clean it up, it's just a mess. I have to tell you, though, that's why Manscaped, they redesigned the electric trimmer. Now, Matt, if you go with the perfect package combo, you got the Manscaped boxer briefs. It's great stuff. You get the Manscaped shirt that Matt has on. You get a great little carrying case. You need a nice toiletry bag. They got one. It's nice, and it's leather. But if you look inside, this is where it really gets neat. And they've redesigned that electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team has perfected the greatest ball hair trimmer ever created. I talked about it, but they just released the new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. Look at that light there, Matt. Ceramic. It's great. Their third generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents. And when I tell you this is premium, I do mean premium. The battery will last up to 90 minutes so you can take a longer shave. The waterproof technology allows you to groom the shower like Craig Allen does. You know, another important part of my life, apparently. And one of the coolest features is that LED light, which illuminates grooming areas for a closer and more precise trimming. They've also upgraded to a 7,000 RPM motor with quiet stroke technology. And let's not forget about that charging stand. Listen, you have friends or relatives over on a Skype or Zoom call. You're leading them through your house. You're saying, hey, look at how clean my bathroom is. Wow! You hit them with the Manscaped, and they're going to respect you for that one. Overall, you can show off your trimmer loud and proud because it is an intelligently designed stand, convenient charging dock powered by USB. You got the USB charger at home. I know you do. And if you get the perfect package combo, it's going to come with that as well. And if you're listening to me speak right now, I want you to experience this firsthand for yourself. Let's get that bush and tush clean. Get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. Make your testies your besties. Matt, I know we both got these packages. We tried them out because you're not going to talk about something that you haven't tried. No word of a lie. Best thing I have in my grooming arsenal. And again, I talked about the nose hair trimmer. Let's pull this bad boy out. If you get the perfect package combo, it comes with the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's a salve. It works very nice. It keeps you nice and I said high and tight, but it keeps you high and tight all day. But the Crop Reviver Ball Toner, spritz a little bit of that on. You're going to feel nice and cool for a little while. It works very good, keeps things nice and clean. And I talked about it, but the Weed Whacker, Matt, this nose hair trimmer, look it up. Go to manscaped.com. Use that promo code FNP so they know that we sent you. You're going to get 20% off your order and free shipping. It's at manscaped.com. Promo code FNP. Your balls will thank you. Big fight in our co-main event, and we have the greatest featherweight of all time in Jose Aldo Jr. taking on Chito Marlon Vera. Matt, for Marlon Vera in 2020, it has been a mixed bag. I have to say that because he ends up losing to Sung Yadong early on in the year, and then they match him up against Sugar Sean O'Malley in the return of the Sugar Show, and it was a huge fight. Everybody was looking forward to it. A lot of people picked Sean O'Malley to win. The Fight Night Picks guys picked Sean O'Malley to win. And Marlon Vera went out there and broke him. He broke him.
He did.
And it was a great performance by Marlon Vera. And this is a guy that he's been in the UFC for some time. He's amassed some quiet wins. And I know the losses are kind of tricky and tough. I mean, Marco Beltran at UFC 180 back in 2014. But you got to focus on the fact this guy's only 28 years old. He's just starting to peak right now. Some of the wins are great. But again, the losses. Marco Beltran, Davey Grant, John Lineker, Hands of Stone. My guy, D. Silva, Douglas Silva, De Andrade, and then Song Yadong. You look at some of the wins. Brad Pickett. I mean, the guy wears a hat. Brian Kelleher. He finished him.
And it wasn't, and not to interrupt, but it wasn't just Brad Pickett. They actually gave Marlon Vera to Brad Pickett for Brad Pickett's retirement fight. He went out there and head kicked him in his hometown. And one of the saddest, like, farewells I've ever seen in MMA. So, shout out to Brad Pickett.
Brad Pickett. You see him sometimes. I mean, we saw him in what? Cage Warriors here recently?
He corners Nathaniel Wood.
Yeah, he corners Nathaniel Wood. A lot of fighters out of the British top team. But you look at Marlon Vera's career, and there's been a lot of finishes. I know he went on that great big streak. Luigi Buren, Guido Canetti, Frankie Sines, Nolene Hernandez, Andre Ewell. Then he loses to Song Yadong. That's going to happen. I mean, Cody Stamen drew against Song Yadong.
I thought he beat Song Yadong, too. I'm just going to say
that. Tight fight, close fight. And for Jose Aldo, the last three, and we talked about it when we considered this one our fight of the night. But Matt, we talk about fighters and Jose Aldo kind of in the same conversation as Anthony Pettis, because Pettis is 33, he's almost 34, Aldo's 34. Aldo, greatest featherweight of all time, Pettis, former lightweight champ. They fought some of the best of the best. And we say, well, has Jose Aldo been washed since the Chad Mendes fight in 2014? I would argue no, because if you look at the losses, McGregor, Holloway, Volkanovski, Moraes, and Piotr Jan. All-timers. And I mean, Piotr Jan's on the cusp. Marlon Moraes, World Series of Fighting all-timer. And Alexander Volkanovski really coming into his own at 145 pounds. Conor McGregor today on Monday was a pound-for-pound number one in the UFC in 2020. So take that for what it's worth. And then you look at the wins. Frankie Edgar, Jeremy Stephens, that was an awesome win. Hanato Moicano, another awesome win. Fazeev had his number here recently. But Jose Aldo, although that fifth round against Piotr Jan wasn't overly competitive, everything else somewhat has been.
Oh, 100%. And again, you're not going to get me talking bad about Jose Aldo. Jose Aldo, ever since I first started watching MMA, been one of my favorite fighters, because you know what you're going to get with a Jose Aldo fight. Some of the best Muay Thai in all of MMA. It has been a little odd, though, ever since the Ricardo Lamas fight. Much more in love with his hands, much more boxing heavy. He will throw the leg kick, and that's been a weird narrative throughout his career, and no one really knows why. Some people say that could it be he has foot injuries or leg injuries. I really think for Jose Aldo, the reason he doesn't kick as much as he used to comes down to cardio. And for Aldo, cardio has always been this weird question mark around his career. And sometimes it's not an issue at all. And then other times he does fade quite heavily as the fight progresses. And the Piotr Jan fight is a really good example of that. He's doing great early on. He's landing the leg kick. He's forcing Jan to switch stances. And you're like, wow, he's really like making Jan dig deep in this fight. I assumed Jan would just kind of run over him. But as that fight progresses, in the fourth round, you can tell, okay, Jan's got his timing, and Aldo's getting tired. He just sort of kept on. He's like erosion at a beach. It just kind of never stops. It's just gradual. That's the problem that Piotr Jan gave to Jose Aldo.
I think the tide normally causes that. People go with the tide.
The tide. Normally, he is just such a grimy fighter. And for Jose Aldo, it's weird. Marlon Vera is the first sort of drop down in his level of competition in his whole UFC run. It's been a while since we have seen Jose Aldo against a guy in that 10 to 15 range. Marlon Vera, it's odd. I understand the Sean O'Malley one was a nice win. It's a good win to have on your record. And it's a win that garnered you a lot more fans. Like, here's... After you beat Sean O'Malley, you see down in Colombia, in Ecuador, there's billboards with Marlon Vera on them now. Like, he's a big star regionally, and I do think the UFC is trying to capitalize on that. And with a win over Jose Aldo, if you thought beating Sean O'Malley made you famous, beating Jose Aldo is going to do that tenfold. So it's a really interesting matchup, and a matchup that we haven't seen Jose Aldo in a very long time.
Matt out here just yelling at kids, get off the dunes, kids! You're going to cause erosion at the beach! Don't ruin the dunes! But Matt, I look at this fight, and I mean, for Jose Aldo, yes, he's lost his last three fights. Alexander Volkanovski, since beating Aldo, before that beat Mendes, so now you get your all-timer featherweights from 6-7 years ago. Then he beat Holloway twice. Marlon Moraes lost that fight by split, and yeah, it is what it is, mixed bag, and he's fighting Rob Font on this card, but that's a good fighter. And Piotr Jan, again, one of my guys from ACB, but he's looked amazing in the UFC. Maybe the Jinsu Sun fight's the only one where he might have got tagged, or even the fight against John Dodson recently released. Hopefully he finds his footing somewhere. Maybe a one championship, maybe even Combate. That'd be a really good spot for him, but I digress. In this fight, it is very competitive. Now, if Marlon Vera is going to get a win in this fight, I would expect him to really bring everything that Marlon Vera has. Do exactly what he did in the Sean O'Malley fight. Start just chopping some of those kicks. I would think, because if you want to get in boxing range with Jose Aldo, look at Hook City to the body. This guy is absolutely deadly in short range.
So I do agree with part of that. The issue is, if you stay in a kicking range with Aldo and you start kicking his leg, he's going to do that to you. And you beat Sean O'Malley because you hit a very specific nerve in the lower part of his calf. And then, of course, the ground and pound was nice. He's not taking down Jose Aldo in this fight. I can't guarantee many things in the world of MMA. Marlon Vera will not be able to take down Jose Aldo. Jose Aldo, one of the better defensive wrestlers in all of MMA. His hips are very reactionary. The second anyone shoots, he's ready to sprawl. And
Again, it's the Joe Roganism when you talk about Jose Aldo, how good he is on the ground, but he never shows his ground game because of his stand-up and how dominant it is. We don't see a lot of his ground game because of his stand-up, but also because his takedown defense is just so phenomenal.
90%!
And yeah, and it's not like he's only fighting, like, borderline okay wrestlers. That includes Chad Mendes, Frankie Edgar, Alexander Volkanovski, like, some of the better MMA wrestlers that we've ever seen. The fact that Jose Aldo can defend 9 out of 10 of every one of those takedown attempts is absolutely insane. It's very odd when I try to think about how Marlon Vera beats Jose Aldo, though. He has good ground and pound for the top position, but I don't know how he gets the fight in that position in the first place. And on the feet, Marlon can have success, but guys who he has trouble with are guys with a power advantage who go to the body and go to the head. John Lineker was able to have success. I understand that was earlier on in Marlon Vera's career, but the fact that he is such a big bantamweight, he stands very upright, the body is open, and we've seen it from Jose Aldo. That Jeremy Stephens finish is just one of my all-time favorite finishes. The left hook he lands and that delayed reaction that Jeremy Stephens showed, the amount of pain that Stephens must have been going through is just astronomical. I really like Jose Aldo in this fight. I love his kicks. I love his boxing. I really like the power that he brings into this fight, too. And when you look at the guys who have given him trouble, especially down at 135, okay, Marlon does a lot of what he does. They're very similar fighters. So, okay, you basically fought Marlon Moraes to a draw. Let's just call it that. It was a close fight. And then Piotr Jan, who has a very unique boxing style, who will kind of wait. He's similar to Floyd Mayweather in that aspect, where he's not just going to go out there and throw a ton of punches. He'll wait. He's very defensively sound. And then once he does get a good read on his opponent, he sort of hits that kill switch. And from that moment on, there's no going back. That's the real scary Piotr Jan. I don't know how Marlon Vera can recreate the success that either one of those two fighters had against Jose Aldo.
I'd be very surprised to see that. And that's why I'm really looking forward to this fight, because I feel like it can be an all-action type of fight. But if we're going to get into a knock-him-down, drag-him-out type of war, I still favor an older Jose Aldo to get the win in that. If we look at the Tapology picks, Matt, 757 of them, 63% going Aldo, 75% predicting him to win by decision. He is the favorite in this fight. He opened up a minus 125. The line dropped. He's now a minus 148. He was as low as a minus 177, so a little bit of money coming in on Marlon Vera right now, who opened a plus 105, got up as high as about a plus 150. He's now at a plus 121. I'm in agreement. I mean, Jose Aldo, well, he has lost those three fights in a row. Volkanovski, it's going to be tough.
He's pretty good.
It's going to be tough. Marlon Moraes, again, I thought that Marlon won the fight. You can make an argument as to Aldo winning the fight. He ended up getting a title shot because Dana White does Dana White stuff. And in the Piotr Jan fight, yeah, he lost that fight. But bad. He lost it bad. But Marlon Vera's riding a heater of a wave right now. I want to know what you're thinking down below in the comments section. Who are you picking to get the win in this one? Are you going with Jose Aldo? We both are. Are you going with Chito Marlon Vera? It's a great fight. Really looking forward to it. We have 15 fights total on the card, so if you missed any of them, check out the playlist over there. We'll continue on with our main event prediction and breakdown for Stephen Wonderboy Thompson taking on Hands of Steel, Jeff Neals. Keep it locked in with Fighting Picks, Matt, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Oh boy, Matt, it is time for our main event of the evening at 170 pounds between Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and Jeff, the Hands of Steel, Neil. Matt, I'm really looking forward to this fight. I mean, Jeff Neal is one of the hottest prospects in this division. It seems like everybody's avoiding him, and it's hard for him to pick up fights. And opposite him, Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, I mean, a lot of people have sat there and thought, Wonderboy, what is the secret to your powers? And only 4.5 guys have really figured it out. I mean, Tyron Woodley being 1.5 of those guys based on the draw and the loss that Wonderboy has on his record. But really, it's been an immaculate run in the UFC, with the exception of, again, the Woodleys, the Darren Till decision loss over in England, and then the knockout loss in front of a big crowd in Nashville to Anthony Pettis, which was just such a weird fight to really think of. But for Wonderboy, I mean, he bounced back in his last time out, which was just over a year ago against Vicente Luque, in a bit of a weird fight because Vicente really finally got that push to, hey, he's a big-name fighter, and he just wasn't able to come up. He came up short in that one against Wonderboy. And with Stephen Thompson, and I have it kind of in the graphics that are going to pop up here, I originally put southpaw as a stance. You could call it switch, you could call it orthodox, you could call it whatever you want. But he has two very distinct styles when he switches stances.
He does, and it's not something we see a lot from fighters. For instance, when Jeff Neal switches stances himself, he does the same thing just from both sides. Paul Felder's a good example. No matter what he does, be it orthodox or southpaw, the techniques will be the same. With Wonder Boy, it's odd because he really only kicks with his right leg. He'll kick with his right leg even if he's in the southpaw position, but he uses it more like a front leg side kick, like more of a probing tool. And then if he's in the orthodox position, that's when he's whipping around those real hard power leg kicks. And it's odd too because Wonder Boy doesn't throw a lot of leg kicks for being so kick heavy himself. He started to do it a little bit more the further along in his MMA career he's come, but it's not like... He's a very primary kick-heavy fighter, but he doesn't go to the legs as often as a lot of other kickers do, so it is kind of an odd thing to see. But with Wonder Boy, he's such a good counter-striker, and that's something you always have to talk about, especially when he's fighting another primary striker like a Jeff Neal. Jeff Neal brings the thunder, and he hits you one time, you go down. And it is odd, and we brought it up in videos before, hell, we were talking about it before this even started. Jeff Neal has some of the best finishing instincts in all of the UFC. He's not going to get you hurt and just bum rush you and try to finish you immediately, and then if he can't land that big shot, he's exhausted. He stays technical and disciplined throughout the whole entire fight.
And the perfect example is his fight that was almost a year ago against Mike Perry, and it's weird, Tapology has it 11 months, 4 weeks ago. To me, that's a full year, but Tapology, you do you. If you watch that fight... Not that he's tentative, but he's calculated when he's striking with Perry, because Perry's going to bring that wildness to his fights. He was coming off the one where he broke his nose in all sorts of different weird ways. It was a weird stylistic matchup. It was a weird matchup to make. It just was. Oh, yeah. Jeff Neal, cerebral, hurts Perry. Perry starts to back up. Jeff Neal, unleash the Kraken, and just goes absolutely buck wild. But when he does go forward, he keeps his hands up. And he's still thinking, and he's landing those power shots until he goes in, crashes, Perry goes down, and the fight's over. Jeff Neal is one of the smartest strikers that you have in this division. And again, lends credence to the fact that nobody wants to fight him because he has so much potential, he has so much power. And he's another one of those prospects at a 4-6 MMA that you have to watch for. So you look at his overall body of work. He loses by rear naked choke in 2013 to Martin Sanoh. Well, that's going to happen. He loses to Kevin Holland by TKO in 2017 before he beats Bilal Williams and then Chase Walden on Contender Series. You're going to lose to Kevin Holland. Kevin Holland just knocked out Jacare Souza cold. It was insane.
He's all right.
So then Jeff Neal comes into the UFC. He submits Brian Camozzi. No, not Chris. He knocks out Frank Camacho. A little bit too small for 170. And gets knocked out.
Nice performance, though.
Beats Bilal Muhammad. That's probably one of the better ones. Beats Nico Price, beats Mike Perry. He was originally scheduled to take on Neil Magny back in August. That one didn't happen. So now he comes in here and takes on Wonder Boy. That's a step up from Neil Magny. So kudos to Wonder Boy for taking this fight, because the rumors were Wonder Boy and Chimaev for the longest time.
Exactly. And again, we don't really know where Chimaev does fit into all of this, but I agree with you. Wonder Boy is a more high profile fight, but I'd argue Neil Magny's a harder stylistic fight for Jeff Neal, because with Wonder Boy, you know what you're going to get. He will stand, he'll play that rangy striking game with you, as opposed to Neil Magny, who, just go back and watch that Robbie Lawler fight that Neil Magny had. He'll make it ugly. He's not afraid to go for the takedown. He is a high volume guy, and he does give guys like Jeff Neal a little bit of trouble. So personally, I'm a little disappointed we never saw that Neil Magny fight, but with the Wonder Boy fight, much more high profile. I like that this is a main event too, because for Jeff Neal, that's been his big trouble. He's in like the Ryan Hall situation where five people know who you are, but you're better than pretty much everyone in the top 15. You just need the opportunity to get your name out there, and fighting Wonder Boy in a main event is the perfect way to do it. I understand Wonder Boy has only won 2 of his last 5, but it's still Stephen Thompson. Like, he has a massive following. Everyone knows he's one of the top guys in the division, and coming off his win over Vicente Luque, listen, you're looking... I run two people's fan clubs. It's Dustin Poirier and Vicente Luque. And when Vicente Luque lost to Wonderboy, I didn't cry, but I definitely went outside and just had to, like, think for a second. Because it was just a weird fight. Luque started out doing really well. He landed big power shots. And then Wonderboy countered him a trillion times and dropped him a bunch. And it hurt my feelings. I don't think Jeff Neal will have the same issue as Luque. Because when you look at the triangle of striking, if you will, if you go power, speed, and cardio, Luque, I would argue, hits harder than both these guys do. Just pure one-shot power. Jeff Neal has a big speed advantage, though, over Vicente Luque. And he might not be as heavy-handed of a fighter as Luque is, but I think that the fact that he is the faster guy makes up for the fact that he isn't as, you know, one-punch heavy as Luque. If he can get to Wonderboy, who we've seen get dropped at this stage in his UFC career, again, before the Woodley fight, he wasn't really even getting hurt. Jake Ellenberger was able to drop him in the Ultimate Fighter finale. Odd fight to think of off the top of my head. But other than that one fight, He'd had a phenomenal chin, and we've seen that as he's gotten a little bit older, I don't know if it has to do with he's a little bit slower with his movement left to right, he can get cracked. Woodley, of course, famously hurt him both times in their first and second fight. The Darren Till fight was odd because it was really 50-50 until Till, of course, dropped him in the fifth round. And then you look at the Anthony Pettis fight. Anthony Pettis at 170, I wouldn't say is a world beater by any means, but the fact that he was able to go out there and KO Wonderboy does make me a little nervous when now you're fighting Jeff Neal, who's like a prime, way bigger Anthony Pettis.
And I mean, a lot of people, and I've seen it in the comments section, I put the picture out there in the YouTube community tab just to say, hey, working on the videos, what do you think about the main event? And there are a couple of people that pointed to the fact that, you know, Jorge Masvidal had lost to Wonderboy, and if Wonderboy can put on a performance like that, it was only 3 years ago, then wow, he has a great opportunity against Jeff Neal. But a lot of people forget the fact that Jorge Masvidal did the high school between university, took a leap year, and after that leap year became a totally different fighter. So keep that in mind. And Jorge Masvidal lost a split decision to Demian Maia before that too, but you're not talking about that because it's not overly relevant. If we look at this fight though, Wonderboy, counter-striking, maybe a little bit of volume, positive strike differential in the UFC, which is always good to see. You know, you talked about some of the knockdowns, that's always worrying. Strikes landed per minute for these two guys, and again, totally different levels of competition, and Wonderboy's been around for much longer. 3.93 landed per minute for Wonderboy to 6.04 landed for Jeff Neal. We talked about the fact that he doesn't normally crash forward, and I said that for a lot of fighters on this card. If you're going to win, you probably need to crash forward, because it's really tough to beat some of these guys in range. You'd think that in a fight against Wonderboy, who uses kicks to set up distance, and he probably has some of the best distance management in the game. You'd think, well, Jeff Neal's got to close that gap and really just rush forward and get him. But no, Jeff Neal's a lot smarter than that. He doesn't need to strike that way. He can throw a lot of different things together. He's fought a lot of good fighters. Again, you talk about a loss to Kevin Holland. I think that's more a learning experience than a tell in this fight. And I know you're going to, people are going to point to that. That was 3 years ago too. So again, sometimes you're going to lose, sometimes you're going to win. Jeff Neal on a big win streak, 7 fights in a row. Wonderboy, 2-3 in his last 5, but again, against the greatest level of competition. And his fifth to last fight against Woodley was almost 4 years ago. So it really kind of puts things into perspective there, Matt. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, at a 786 total votes, 65% going with Wonderboy, picking him to win by decision, 77% of that 65. The 35% that are picking Jeff Neal to win, 64% have him by knockout. And if we have a look at the odds, they're about at par. Wonderboy opened minus 115, went down to minus 175, and then that line just continued to creep up, minus 110 for Wonderboy. For Jeff Neal, open plus 105, got as high as a plus 150, now at a minus 113. So people are going with Jeff Neal on the Underground Whisper Network, as we say, over on the Tapology votes. The fans are going with Wonderboy. The dollar amounts are going with Jeff Neal. Matt, it is a really tough one to try and predict because it's such a clash of styles in terms of striking styles. So overall, what do you make of this one in the end here?
So I do agree with the Tapology votes for once. I like how more people think that Wonderboy is probably going to win. But if Neal wins, it's more likely not going to be by KO. It's hard to beat Wonderboy in a 5-round fight in a striking exchange because you know his cardio is always going to be there. His ability to counter is just going to improve as the fight progresses. And he's such a rangy guy at 170 that Jeff Neal, he's never fought anyone like Wonderboy Thompson. Whereas Wonderboy, he's fought guys like Vicente Luque, who can fight in a similar style to Jeff Neal. He's fought the Rory McDonalds. He's fought the Jorge Masvidals. All that being said, I still like Jeff Neal in this. He's the younger version and does a lot of what made Wonderboy so good in the first place. And Wonderboy, when you look at his record, he's not one of these guys like a Travis Luter who has a trillion fights, or Travis Fulton, sorry. But he has taken quite a bit of damage throughout his UFC career, and especially over that last little 5-fight run. Fighting a guy like Jeff Neal is not the type of dude you want to be testing your durability against, and I can see Jeff Neal landing a big left straight at some point in this fight, hurting Wonderboy, and then just putting it on him from there. So I like Jeff Neal in this one, but I've got to admit, I can see Wonderboy slipping a punch, cracking him with a straight left, and doing the exact same thing to Jeff Neal.
I like Jeff Neal in this fight too, Matt, and I, you know, you really point to a good aspect. If Steve Wonderboy Thompson is going to win this fight either, yeah, you know, he could finish Jeff Neal. It's happened. You talk about the fact that Jeff Neal hasn't really fought a tall, rangy striker like that before. I gotta bring it up again. That Kevin Holland.
He doesn't kick like
I know. They don't kick, but they're very tall, very rangy. Whether it's at 170 or 185 or wherever the hell Kevin Holland decides he wants to fight, because I think he's paved a path.
Oh,
he could fight John Jones heavyweight tomorrow if he wanted to, and I bet they'd sign that contract, but John Jones wouldn't. In terms of this fight, though, Jeff Neal, yes, I like the pass to victory. I like the power. I like the controlled wildness. I like the fact that there's so many different angles that he can cut himself as well. And I think he poses just that special challenge to Wonderboy where I think Jeff Neal can take it. Again, Vicente Luque, you talk about the cardio. It's there. The Barbarina fight worried me in the third round. But it is there. With Jeff Neal, you know, you've had the opportunity to train for a five-round fight here the last couple of months. Not to say that Wonderboy hasn't. It's been a long time since we've seen Wonderboy, over a year at this point. 37 years old. Again, he could go in there and have a game like, I don't know, pick an old, not really, Channing Frye's not the player I could
like
think
after
of.
Kobe Bryant tore his Achilles and in his last game ever when he had scored 60, Wonderboy could have put on one of those performances. The difference is, Kobe Bryant's one of the greatest athletes to ever walk foot on the face of this earth. Wonderboy's a very good athlete, but I don't know if I have him in the same
like
state.
Channing Frye just open shooting threes, and that's about it. Like Jared Dudley just being there for the boys. But Matt, overall in this fight, NBA references aside, I'm going with Jeff Neal. I really do think he has a great opportunity in this fight. It should be a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Disagreeing with the Tapology picks, but yeah, slightly siding with the odds, I guess, or at least where they're trending. I think it's going to be great. You're going with Jeff Neal as well. And overall, Matt, this is the last prediction video of 2020, unless things change during the week and we have to change things. But we really do have to thank everybody out there this year. I mean, we've totally changed around the studio that we have. Our microphone stopped working a couple of weeks ago. People hit us up in the super chat over on Question Mark Kicks, which is on Saturdays before the fights. Helped us out. We picked up a new microphone. We've got a new camera. Like, it's been an absolutely incredible year. Matt's on with Fight Night Picks full time. It's just absolutely wild, and we couldn't thank everybody out there enough. I had the opportunity to stand behind about 25 people at the post office today to ship some shirts out. And that helps us out as well. So check out the website, fightnightpicks.net. You can always find us Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FMP, at Matt Allen FMP, at Fight Night Picks. And yeah, I'm looking forward to a crazy 2021. I know we're working on a couple of extra things. Now, we teased that the last time. We ended up coming out with This Week in MMA and changing up a couple of things. But I've got a couple more things coming down the pipe and a few other things before the end of the year. So I just wanted to say thanks.
Yeah, hashtag free Craig 2021. That's the real goal for next year. Listen, 2020, I think we can all agree, was not a great year. But guess what? We built something really cool here, and we couldn't do it without the community, being you guys. So yeah, if you support us, we love making the content for you. And let's just make sure 2021 is the best year ever.
Yeah, so hopefully you have a good holidays. I'm sure we'll be seeing you around. We got a lot, like I said, we have a lot of stuff planned before the end of the year. So let's do this in sync, Matt. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it.